Okay, members, we're ready to go. Welcome. And we'll start with Representative Huntley. House File 1855. Good morning. Welcome to the committee, Representative Huntley.
We're going to start without... We don't have a quorum yet.
We do have a quorum, I think.
Oh,
don't we?
Okay. Then I would move House File 1855 be recommended to pass. And is there a... Just trying to decide whether where this is supposed to go.
To finance.
Okay. And that it be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. This is a bill that relates to reporting of uncompensated care by hospitals, and it also relates to...
Representative, you do have an amendment, I see.
Yes.
Okay. Do you want to move that now?
Oh, they got one here. You're talking to 380?
380.
I would move then that the 380 amendment be adopted.
All in favor of the amendment, do so by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Amendment is adopted.
And then I have an oral amendment on page 12. Strike.
Of the amendment?
No, this is of the... Oh, this is of the amendment. Okay. I should have done that first, Madam Chair. So I guess it's in the... Well, it's to the amendment, but the amendment's in the bill, so I guess I'm amending the... But you can find it on page 12 of the amendment. And deletes lines 1222 through 1224, which relates to rulemaking. And then on line 1229. Is Randy here? Yeah. Yeah, after line 1228, insert a new number 8, which will read, from outpatient surgical centers, the total number of surgeries performed. And then 1229, change the 8 to a 9. And Mr. Chun, if you then go down to 1231, there at the end of that line, there's a 9 that should be converted to a 10. And on 1232, there is a 10 which should be converted to an 11.
Okay, do all members have that oral amendment? To the oral amendment? All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed, nay?
Then I have some people here to describe the bill.
Okay.
From the Department of Health.
Good. Welcome to the committee. And please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Julie Sonier. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Health, and I'll be speaking today on the portions of the amendment that was just adopted that relate to the department's study on medical facilities investments. We did distribute a fact sheet on the study and its major findings and recommendations, and what this amendment does is implement the recommendations that are related to data collection authority. Essentially, what we found in the study is that our current data collection systems for hospitals, surgical centers, imaging centers provide a solid foundation for analysis of market trends, but we did identify some specific gaps which we're proposing this legislation to fill those gaps. Specifically, what it would do is it would collect information from hospitals on the numbers and occupancy rates of beds in specialized units such as cardiac care or mental health care. It would collect information from surgical centers on the total numbers of surgeries performed each year at the facilities. Currently, we only get the top 10 surgeries performed. And for diagnostic imaging facilities, it would do three things. First, it would fill a rather large gap in the state's current knowledge about diagnostic imaging. Current reporting requirements apply only to facilities whose primary purpose is imaging. And so if there is imaging capacity at other locations, such as physician clinics, those are outside the scope of current reporting, and that is a large and growing gap in the state's knowledge about medical facilities investment. So it would level the playing field by expanding those reporting requirements to all the facilities that are providing those services. Second, it would add information on the numbers of scanners at each facility to existing reports. And third, it would make a technical correction to current law that would reduce the administrative burden associated with current requirements to report the names of everyone with a financial or economic interest in the facility. This change would limit it to only physicians or other people who have a 10% or greater ownership stake in the facility. In addition to these data collection requirements, we also recommended one other change to existing law. We would change the current retrospective reporting and review of major capital expenditures that occurs under Minnesota Statute 62J17 into an annual reporting system. We believe that by transitioning these into an annual report, we could collect relevant information about medical facilities investment in a way that's much more efficient, uniform, and ultimately useful. In addition, the current retrospective review system is not believed to have had much impact on capital investment decisions, and for this reason, MDH has recommended the repeal of the regulatory portions of 62J17.
Thank you. Excuse me. Please state your name for the test record.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Kristen Longcourage from the department, and to the amendment, I'll speak to sections 5, 6, and 7. Section 5 is on page 6, line 4 of the bill. These sections were statutory changes requested by the Administrative Uniformity Committee, and you have a fact sheet in your packet of fact sheets. I believe it's on page 3 of that. Section 5 and Section 6 are adding some language to allow critical access hospitals to be able to elect a type of billing that's allowed under Medicare called Method 2 billing. It allows these critical access hospitals to bill their professional fees either on the 1500 claim form or the CMS 1450 claim form. And this is requested by the Administrative Uniformity Committee to give these critical access hospitals more flexibility in their payment system so that we're matching federal Medicaid requirements. So that's Section 5 and 6. Section 7 and Section 8 relate to the standard patient identification card. This is language that was inadvertently deleted in the last legislative session, in 2006 legislative session, and the AUC has requested that this language be put back. You'll see on line 7.8, it just requires that the standard label on the patient ID card come before the data element. So name must come before your name on the identification card. So that's easy for patients to find that information. And then line on 9.2 and 9.3, just adding back that the label of service type should be on the standard patient ID card. So that's easy for patients to find. And those are those changes from the Administrative Uniformity Committee. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Any questions, members? Representative Huntley.
Well, Madam Chair, this bill, well, I don't think it's controversial. I think we should just pass it. It gives us information about some of the more controversial things. And most of us are aware of the very controversial debate over imaging between the health plans and the providers that's going on in another bill. And this bill will at least give us some information as to try to understand that dispute. So I think it's very important, and we need this information, and I urge you to support the bill.
Thank you. Members, any questions? If not, we'll go, we'll refer this to the Finance, House File 1855. All in favor, do so by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The bill is referred to Finance. Thank you, Representative Huntley. Pardon, Representative? Oh, you're still up. What does he have? Okay. And Representative Huntley, I believe you're doing 2159 for Representative Abler. Are you ready for that, or do you want me to?
Madam Chair, no, I'm not ready.
Okay. Well, we'll go on to, and let you get ready. We'll go on to Representative Loeffler, House File 2182. Welcome to the committee, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I would like to move that House File 2182 be referred to the Finance Committee, and I have a DE1 amendment I'd like to have adopted.
So moved, and to the amendment.
Members, this proposal implements the top recommendation of the legislative auditor in their January 2007 report on Human Services Administration. It's a 107-page report. We have one of the people who put it together here, Deborah Junod, who worked on the report, would be glad to provide testimony, but doesn't need to unless we have questions. But I think its top recommendation, and there's a summary in your packet, is that the legislature should establish working groups to streamline human services program requirements and consider changes in human services funding policy. Their major findings were that Minnesota's human service system has challenges and performance problems that are not being adequately addressed by the state, that's us, and counties, that human services access costs and outcomes vary significantly around the state, that Minnesota's approach to funding human services contributes to inconsistencies in local tax burdens and services, and that there's particular challenges with the smaller counties, and that the complexity in laws and administrative requirements has made service administration more burdensome than necessary. And we see the hundreds of bills that we have been spending a lot of time, night and day, reviewing. But I don't know that people are aware of as much all the hundreds of pages of rules that direct our counties and the administration and implementation of these programs, and what's called bulletins, DHS bulletins. Last year alone, there were 101 DHS bulletins, both in just informational as well as instructional bulletins that change the requirements for program administration. So twice a week, your county are getting new information about how to do their job. And as a result, it's not surprising that inconsistencies arise. And I would actually like to encourage us to, in the interim, if we're looking for topics to actually have a hearing on, to actually, when we're a little calmer and a little less overwhelmed, actually spend some time actually hearing more of the detail on this report, because I think we haven't really gotten a full appreciation for the complexity that we have created in the implementation of all these laws that we take so much time to pass. The bill creates a task force or a county an advisory committee established by the commissioner that will include legislators, county representatives, and state agency staff. And it will annually select up to two topics for review. The goals of the review are to discuss opportunities for administrative improvements, to increase simplification and streamlining, to improve consistency, efficiency, fairness, and to reduce the risk of recipient noncompliance. It'll look at current challenges, funding, whether there's, you know, geographic issues that make it more difficult to have consistency across the state, and they'll report back to us on December 15th of each year. And I have to say that early in my career when I worked in education policy, it was the tradition of the legislature back then that every year they would pick a couple of topics in their many long list, laundry list, and every year they'd say, okay, we're going to look at, for example, school transportation and community education, and they would, over the interim, have their staff and the state agency staff and school district staff work together to just do a review of what are we doing, what are other states doing, what can we do better, and it meant that every program kind of thoughtfully got a regular review and airing. It also kind of helped manage the committee's work because they could say, you know, that's scheduled for work next year and you wouldn't have to hear every bill. We tend to sort of change every program in some way every year, and it might actually be an interesting way for us to manage our work. So I think this is an experiment worth trying in human services to bring all the actors together in a thoughtful way to look at these issues. And with that, I will take questions. I have a couple of sets of fires, and they don't need to do that.
Okay, excuse me. Representative Loffler, I think we do need to move your amendment. Adopt your amendment.
Absolutely.
And let's do that. And I, is that the?
The DE1 amendment.
All right, members, all in favor of adopting the DE1 amendment, do so by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted. Continue, Representative Loffler.
With that, Madam Chair, I will just stand for questions. Like I said, there's people who would be willing to testify, but if people want to continue to move on and there are questions, they would be happy with that as well. It is supported by the counties, and DHS has been involved in helping construct this language.
Okay. Members, any questions for Representative Loffler? If not, we will go. We will refer the House File 2182 to Finance as amended. All in favor? Please say aye.
Aye.
And opposed, nay. And it is off to Finance, the House File 2182. Thank you very much, Representative Loffler. Good work. Mm-hmm. Representative Liebling. Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move House File 2184 and
to Finance.
We need to move it to Finance. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So moved. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Okay. Well, Representative Tina Liebling from Rochester District 30A, and this, members, is a bill that has to do with medical education research cost distribution, and I have with me Frank Yossi from the Mayo Clinic, who's going to explain and discuss the bill.
Good morning.
Good morning. Madam Chair and members, my name is Frank Yossi. I'm representing Mayo Clinic today. Bill is very, very similar to the administration of the Department of Health's proposal in reaction, proposal which is a reaction to the Federal Centers for Medicaid and Medicare services regarding the Minnesota distribution of medical education funds. The only thing that's different about this bill is the funding source. The department's proposal funds it out of the Health Care Access Fund, and this bill funds it out of the general fund. Just to give the Health Finance Committee an option. With that, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Members, do you have questions? Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair and members, I don't have a question, but this is a kind of a controversial item. That's how this money is distributed. And for those that don't know, it primarily goes to institutions that have residency programs in medicine. There is a small amount of money that goes for nurse practitioners and some other things, but it's to help pay for the cost of these educational programs. The question is, how do you distribute that money? And you have the Mayo Clinic obviously has a huge number of residents in all their programs, and as well as there are other programs all over the state, particularly in the Twin Cities. A few small one in Duluth, I must say. And so how are you going to distribute this money? And it gets very controversial and as to who gets the most of it. And sometimes we have to not be parochial, and I think the state is very privileged to have the Mayo Clinic here, and sometimes we have to be nice to them. And, you know, I don't know exactly what we're going to do in the finance division, but we have to make sure that the Mayo Clinic and the money is spread around the state and where it's needed. But it is, I want to tell you, it's I get certainly lobbied by groups on both sides of this issue.
And others, I'm sure, to the testifier.
Madam Chair, just for the record, I'd like to say that Mayo Clinic very much likes to be in Minnesota most of the time. As Representative Holley mentioned, this issue is a decades-long policy of having the money for medical education follow the students, and what that means is that those of us who provide most of the medical education in Minnesota, which is primarily Mayo and the University of Minnesota, have been the prime recipients of these funds, and that's one side of the controversy. The other side is that it should be going to those who provide the most Medicaid. The issue is, at least I wasn't involved in this, it was better than 10 years ago, the state decided that this policy was the appropriate one, that we needed to provide to educate more physicians in this state and to provide some support for it. And the federal government made it clear that there was a portion of the Medicaid payment that was for medical education. The state decided to carve that portion out and create a fund, which is what was the start of this program. And the issue is whether, again, as I mentioned, whether it should go to the people that train the physicians and others, or whether it should go to those who have high Medicaid percentages. So we look forward to this discussion.
Thank you. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to our witness, and to Representative Huntley. I actually remember when Mayo didn't get medical education and didn't seek it, because at that point you had such a great international business. I think you didn't think it was as critical, and I think the economy's changed and a lot of things have changed, and I think you've been welcomed in as a key part of that distribution committee. But I wanted to say that I think we, over time, need to start looking at this in terms of the priorities, and I noticed that on page 4, and I assume that this is in the health department bill as well, it actually awards grants relate to increased mental health access and providers in that area. And I would really like to see us do a lot more in looking at how much we're relating our medical education to the future needs of our healthcare workforce. And Representative Huntley's done a great job of talking about how we're, you know, sort of tilted towards certain specialties with an inadequate flow of primary care and internal medicine docs coming into the system. Gerontology, as we're confronting a huge demographic age shift, and we'll have more seniors than we've ever had before, gerontology programs have not been growing. In fact, I've heard that some of them have been cut back. And so I think we really need to, as this evolves, and hopefully as we have more expansive budgets in the future, look at whether or not additional dollars in this can actually help start shifting our training program to the critical workforce needs that we're going to face over the next 20 years, not just keep our existing programs alive, but start to help rebalance the system of who's coming out and what kind of specialties are they choosing.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair and Representative Loeffler, I couldn't agree more with you. In fact, this proposal, as you pointed out, does have some money in there to provide incentives for underserved areas, specialty areas. And mental health is clearly the poster child for that. Mayo has about 25% of the children's mental health beds, and they are constantly full. Many of the patients from the Twin Cities area. And to a bill that has been entertained here in this committee and in the Finance Committee, rearranging and readjusting those financial incentives for those kinds of specialties, and providing incentives for those kinds of, for people to go into those kinds of specialties, is the way to correct the problem of increase, or at least one of the ways to address the problem of increasing expenditures on facilities.
Thank you. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Liebling, just so I'm clear, this doesn't change the way the funds are distributed. This changes where the funds are coming from now to the general fund. Is that correct?
Well, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hamilton, yes and no. There are different proposals out there. This is the same as, I think, the governor's proposal. Am I right, Mr. Yossi? So this is a proposal that's already out there, and it's already, I think, in another bill that's already... It's already in consideration. But the difference between this and that is the source of the funds, because the governor takes the funds from the Health Care Access Fund, which many of us, I think, are opposed for a variety of reasons, and instead takes it from the general fund.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions from any other members? Representative Liebling, to the bill.
Okay, so, Madam Chair, if there are no other questions, I would renew my motion that this pass and be referred to the Finance Committee.
Representative Liebling, members, we will vote on House File 2184 to be referred to Finance. All in favor of that, do so by saying aye.
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 And opposed, nay. The ayes have it. It will be referred to Finance. Thank you very much, Representative Liebling. Now we have Representative Huntley with House File 2159.
I'm filling in for Madam Chair, for Representative Abler, who's trying to pay the rent on his clinic today.
Well, welcome again, Representative Huntley, and please state your name and proceed.
Okay, I'm Representative Tom Huntley, and this is Jim Abler's bill, but I'm a co-author, and I've always, for a long time, supported this particular program. We have a number of people here to discuss it, and people have, I've been in, city council, I think, in 1981, and everything I've learned in government that is, everybody says, but it saves money in the long run. And most of them don't. This is a program that does save money in the long run. And it deals with treating kids that have severe medical problems. They're the high-cost kids. Mm-hmm. And we have Dr. Kelly here from the university to describe the program. And then we have Dr. Voice to discuss what we... included in the bill is a new emphasis on mental health as well. So, Dr. Kelly, you want to...
Very good. Welcome, go. Dr. Kelly. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dr. Ann Kelly. I'm from the University of Minnesota, and I'm the director of the Youth Special Kids Program. The Youth Special Kids Program is a program I started about 10 years ago to target children that had very complicated medical conditions, who spent a lot of time in the hospital and generally were very difficult to discharge to home because of their complexity, and no one in the community that really could manage all of their care needs, and then often were readmitted frequently to the emergency room and then to the hospital just as quickly as a revolving door. So I felt that that group of children would benefit from a case management team, a small case management team of nurses and myself, who could be on the receiving end. Essentially, we're the community equivalent, I say, of an intensive care unit, so that we can begin to manage those patients in the outpatient setting to prevent them from ending up back in the emergency room in the hospital. So it started as a small program about 10 years ago and has grown since that time, initially funded by grants and then eventually funded through the legislature with the support of Representative Huntley and Senator Berglund. And the model has been very successful in reducing that revolving door of readmissions to the hospital. And I think that's where we see very significant cost savings for this patient population. And when I was asked to expand this model, I felt that we could really grow this support for the whole entire state, for children from all around the state with these complex conditions, if we added a 24-hour advanced practice nurse triage line specifically for this patient group to be on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to both know their conditions, know their medical history, know their problems, and further avoid emergency room utilization. I also ask that we consider adding a mental health case management team that we could work very closely with, because I felt we were not doing an adequate job of the mental health cases, medically fragile kids with mental health cases. So I think that would be another addition that could make us a very effective, novel program, I think, a resource for the state, a medical home, if you will, for the state's children that are medically fragile with both mental health conditions and medical conditions.
Thank you, Dr. Kelly. Representative Hutler, I see we do have a DE1 amendment.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to move the DE1. But before we, but I'd also like to modify the DE1.
Okay.
And to show you how successful Dr. Kelly is, we want to remove subdivision 7 on page 3. And then if you go also to page 5, I would like to remove lines 515, 516, and 517. And the reason we're doing that, that's a $500,000 item that they've just received a grant to do. So you don't have to pay for that.
Oh, great. Wonderful.
So with those changes, Madam Chair, I'd like to move the DE1 amendment.
Okay, members, to the DE1 amendment as amended, all in favor do so by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The amendment as amended is adopted. All right, let's welcome to the committee. Dr. Boyes, is it?
Yes.
Yes, welcome, and please state your name and proceed.
Thank you for hearing us today. I'm Dr. Chris Boyes. I'm a pediatric neuropsychologist at the University of Minnesota in the pediatric psychology program. And when Dr. Kelly, who I work with already in the youth special kids program, approached me about this expansion, it is something that we've been working on for a while in pediatric psychology just on our own to try and expand a parallel program for the catastrophic high-risk mental health kids that are very, very complicated out in the community and end up in the behavioral ERs and in the behavioral inpatient units for 72-hour stays and then in the residential treatment programs for 30-day stays or more, which tend to be very, very spendy beyond what we can do with having the kids with a coordinated approach with the outpatient services, the pediatricians talking with the psychiatrists, have the management on board. So it'd be a very similar program. One of the unique parts of it is these are the kids that the county social workers and the residential treatment centers send to us because it's beyond their scope of work. They've already tried. The kids have often had multiple evaluations on the community, which, again, is if we can streamline community utilization of resources, we can get one good eval done, draw all of the appropriate outpatient services in, and keep these kids out of the behavioral ERs, inpatient and residential programs. After talking with St. Joe's Children's Home and getting some numbers from our own behavioral ER and that, for a kiddo to have two cycles of inpatient and residential, it can be $22,000 to $25,000 a year. That would be additional, kind of beyond what we would need to do if we can keep them out of those sites. So these are not inexpensive kids that we can address with a coordinated community approach similar to Dr. Kelly's. So the unique part is these are the kids that the residential centers are sending to us saying we don't know what to do with these kids, and especially when we send them out, as well as the county caseworkers are already sending these, you know, somewhat train wreck kids to us where they've been through the loop of outpatient services. There has been no case management, and we can serve that function for them to make sure we're accessing the correct services, getting the kids conceptualized the correct way so we get the appropriate services to make it the most efficient that we can.
Thank you. Any questions for these folks, members? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Huntley. I assume that many of these kids in that community care experience are in the what was called CAC, the Children's Alternative for Community Care, the MA waiver program. And I'm wondering why we would, and if we ought to ponder whether or not we should, instead of doing direct general fund appropriations, be looking at enhancing the benefits reimbursement through that program and getting the feds to pick up half the cost as a way to, you know, not only assure that these kids get the care that they need and that you get the appropriate financing to do it, but that we actually are able to get some federal participation in this. And I'm just interested in whether or not that's been considered.
Dr. Kelly.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Only a portion of the children in our program actually have qualified for the CAC waiver. I'm not exactly sure why that is, but they don't seem to meet the criteria for the medically fragile components of that. So we have a number of kids that do have CAC waiver that are tracheostomy dependent or medically technology dependent that we do also provide case management for. And we generally only have to step in for that. The CAC waiver children, we tend to have a lot of case management if they are extreme. And I think those are the children that aren't well managed on CAC waiver are the children that have a combination of mental health problems and medical. And they need more of an intensive sort of support for that. So but not the majority of the children that we take care of, I think, that have complex conditions fall through the cracks. They are not children that are on any type of case management program that is managing all of their needs. Or there's one extreme. They have no one or they have too many, and no one's working together. So,
Madam Chair, to the testimony, I can understand the sometimes too many. I've heard of a lot of complex families where, you know, one advisor is saying tough love and the other is the kid isn't getting enough nurturing and self-esteem building. And, you know, I mean, it doesn't work to have inconsistent messages from all the places that are trying to help. But so I'm totally supportive of what you're doing. I'm just wondering, we ought to look at the eligibility criteria for CAC and some of those other sorts of things so that we could actually make it work as an enhanced funding stream and to get the right kids to you through that process.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions, members? Okay. Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair, I'd then urge you to support House File 2159 and that it be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Division or Finance Committee.
Representative Huntley, we will refer that to 2159. Members, all in favor to refer to Finance as amended, do so by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The ayes have it. It is referred to Finance as amended. Thank you very much, Representative Huntley and testifiers. And members, we are in recess until after session, room 5.
The long-term care consultation section, we are striking obsolete language that requires long-term care consultants to recommend a case mix. No longer do they do that function. That's something that happens within the nursing facilities. And in the alternative care sections, that's section 11 through 21, we're making some clarifications to existing policy. It's modifying some terminology such as lead agency, remove some outdated language to cash payments because we're now using the consumer-directed community supports methodology in the alternative care program, and then also outdate delete some sections related to residential settings that are no longer covered under alternative care. And then in the last section in Article 4 relates to nursing facilities. We are updating a cross-reference there. We are making a date change that was overlooked in 2005, and then also updating the index that is no longer being printed. And then by way of, so we don't have musical chairs, in Article 6, there's several repealers there related to continuing care programs. One is day training and habilitation, and that basically is repealing language that has to do with children in day training and habilitation centers. Since the early 90s, that has not been the case. The Stills language, there's outdated language there that we're repealing. And then also, again, the alternative care program repealing sections that have to do with residential settings.
Thank you very much. Questions, members? Okay. Anything further, Representative Loeffler? There's another amendment here, it looks like.
Yes, we do have another amendment. But we do have another section of bill that we have.
Oh. Please proceed. Thank you.
I'm Deb Moses from the Chemical Health Division. I'm sorry, I was in another hearing. And Article 2 in the Chemical and Mental Health section, all of the changes that we've made are completely technical. And would you like me to just go through them?
Yes, please do.
They all pertain to, we've taken out terms that aren't repeat, that are defined but aren't repeated again in the bill. In the chemical dependency section, we've also taken out some grants that were in the bill that are actually, they were gotten rid of in 1976 due to the Community Services Act and never were taken out.
Can you just point to us generally,
okay,
where we are in the bill?
We're at Article 2, 254A.02 is where we're starting.
It sounds like we're just walking through Article 2 okay. From the beginning, is that right? But we should, if we could have reference, that would be helpful.
Okay.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are we going to take questions as we're moving along, or are we going to wait?
Sure. Do you have a question, Representative Walker?
Yeah. We're actually on page 8. He started on page 8.
Okay.
Which one are you on right now? Have you gone to Section 2 yet?
I'm sorry, I was going through our briefing, or rather through the order. Section 2, the removal of the dependents chronologically, is that the question?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't catch your name, ma'am. I understand that most of this is just dealing with obsolete language and just cleanup, but I'm not sure where did this piece come from? And why it's so important to get rid of the chronological age?
Ms. Moses?
I'm sorry.
Members, we're on page 10.
Okay. Members, Mr. Chair, Amy Delwell, Department of Human Services. That section has to do with children with developmental disabilities. Mm-hmm. And the chronological age piece is confusing to folks because if they, for instance, if they wanted to purchase a toy, that making it refer to the chronological age of a person, maybe they're 16 and the toy is 12, it's confusing to people. And so we tried to make it more clear to say it just needs to be according to their plan, as opposed to identify it specifically to what their chronological age is.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. And so where in what part of the language does the part that you just said you're trying to make it more clear? Because I understand why, you know, you would take that piece out, but making sure that your intent is still in law.
Well, 10.23 says consistent with the needs identified in the individual service plan.
President Walker?
Mr. Chair, I'll settle for that for now.
Okay, thank you. Proceed, okay. Ms. Moses.
On page 11, the first strike is just getting rid of an obsolete citation. If we move down to section 4, rules for chemical dependency, those terms are stricken because we no longer use that language for placement. We just use chemical dependency treatment and housing services. We no longer use the words outpatient, inpatient.
Thank you.
You move down, you'll see there are the more statutes, outdated citations. Moving on to page 12, lines 12.11, that's just language that clarifies how the money is split up with the American Indian money and takes out the citations that were year specific that are no longer in effect. Page 13, on line 13.19, that's language that's no longer needed since we changed our billing system to MMIS and it's not the process that we use anymore. Page 14, lines 14.8 are also that same issue of the change to MMIS. Page 15, on the top of the page, line 15.4, that's again the billing issue, again, that's no longer the process. Page 16, line 16.21, this is just to clarify that the supervisor, rather than, this is about supervision of services, and that it's that the supervisor is present, that's what was always meant, that the person that meets the definition of supervisor. And we're moving to page 19 on the top, we took out the word minimum because that we were told that was confusing to people. It has to be a 3-hour block of time or more, and minimum just appeared to be confusing.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ava.
Somehow I remember this deal. Would that make any implication on the payments? That minimum might imply that if you do at least 3, you get paid, but 3 hours might imply if you do 4, you get paid more?
If you did.
In terms of rent reimbursements and stuff?
It's my understanding that minimum wouldn't tie to any reimbursement. I'm not sure of how that would work.
Thanks. It doesn't.
It was always meant to be 3 hours of service or more.
So.
And Ms. Moser, Representative Lofton, these are all technical changes. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman and members, I have been assured by the department that all of these do not change current use and practice. Some of these things have been in rules or instructional bulletins and clarified there, but they felt it was better to clarify them in the statute.
Do members have any specific
and
questions?
They've been reviewed by a lot of people outside, which is why we took off everything that had any concerns about it I had heard of.
I think we'll just see if anybody has any specific questions as to the language.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
I think you're doing the right thing. I'm not sure we're in a position to judge a lot of this stuff anyway. Mr. Lafler, could you just comment about what groups have scrutinized this and they tell us that this is a bill that's good to go, like the AMC and MICA and whatever other groups have signed off on it?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Abler, I have not pulled every potential group, but we have heard from representatives of the disability community with concerns. I think there were some areas of the continuing care language that was dropped out because of that. The MFIP provisions, because they're drafted in Representative Walker's bill, were taken out here. The child care provisions were taken out. So I think there's been a lot of different groups have been reviewing this as it's gone through. I can't say that any potential impact hasn't, because it's really exciting reading, as you know. But I think we've had it out there, and I think the people who are seriously impacted by this have mostly been looking at it.
Just one more. Could you comment on, like, what counties have thought about this? Are they mostly fine with this, like the social service directors and the different groups about that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, I have not heard from the counties. They do have staff that are sitting here in our hearings, and Kat, I see one representative from Hennepin County here, and she's nodding that they haven't identified any issues. In fact, we have an amendment here that got dropped from the initial draft that they asked us to add in. It's just the amendment will be adopted.
Well, Mr. I'm just not trying to be difficult. Our lobbyist is out due to death in her family, and so she's not been around to observe this. But it's, you know, you guys are all kind of the same page. So the enthusiastic head nodding in the audience reassures me. So thank you. Anybody else in the audience that wants to testify about this bill?
Mr. Chairman, I'm just looking at the last page, and I don't think it's important, but I'm going to ask anyway, because we've had these repealers that have come through.
And I think there should be a set of repealers. Actually, the language should be attached after that amendment. No, there's a separate piece of paper. Lift up the next page in front of you. Right there, I think.
Oh, I see. Okay, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, we have anticipated the committee's needs.
No, this, and I think it's a much better way to proceed. So. So we'll just take them, give you a moment to glance through that. Any other questions, members? Representative Norton.
Chair Thiessen, Tessa first, could you just, and I know it's back a ways, but if you would just clarify for me on 14.9, it talked about with a limiting rate increase for years that are now past. And so if I understand this correctly, it there must have been a time where there was a concern for rate increases, but we're not concerned about that any longer? Because as far as I'm reading this, and I may be misreading it, it takes any restrictions off for rate increases for vendors? And maybe it's just not an issue anymore, and it was between 2003 and 2005.
Mr. Chair and Representative Norton, I think that, as you know, all of these are outdated references, and the current rates provisions, I suspect, are in rule. But, you know, we update the budget regularly, and I think this is part, it's noted in their summary as one of the outdated provisions. So I assume it's just based on the years.
And I understand that that's why the language is coming out, but as I understand it, as we take it out, we're also taking out any cap, if you will, or any restriction. And I just wanted to make sure that is what we're doing and we're comfortable with it. Obviously, it came off. This provision ended in 2005, and so in 2006, maybe there's not an issue anymore. Maybe they just needed to restrict it during some tight times.
Those were added in for year specific. There is nothing at this time in statute. When those were put into statute, they were put in for those years. So they would have to be introduced again year specific.
Okay. So why do we keep them in there? Is that the question? We're deleting it. I got it. Okay.
Yeah, we're deleting that. And I just wondered if there was a need. I understand that the language is obsolete now, but is there a need to keep in that 3% cap? This was really what I'm getting at. And apparently not, or that's the recommendation.
All right. And it was put in for 1 year, is what we're saying, and we have to re-up that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, actually, I think the providers would be revolting if they couldn't increase more than 3% above the 2001 rate. I suspect that wouldn't be enough to operate a program.
Further questions, members? Did you want to do that amendment, Representative Loeffler?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would like to move the 0143 amendment. This has to do with a pilot project that has closed out, or it was expected to end, but it needed to have some of the bookkeeping and things still wrapped up after that date. So the intention is just to wrap up that project as was intended, but some things needed to get cleaned up past the end date of it.
Okay. Does everybody understand the amendment, members?
No.
I think what it's saying is that this pilot project was going to end in 2005, And they had some business that carried on a little bit past 2005, and so we just want to give them. Are they done?
It's
till the end of June. Yes.
It's just till the end of June.
So just to wrap it up then. All right. Seeing no further discussion on that amendment, or no discussion. Well, I guess there was discussion. No further discussion on that amendment. All in favor of that, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? All right. Okay. Further discussion to the bill members. Did you look at the repealers? Okay. Representative Walker.
I do have just a question in general as it relates to the repealers. And Representative Lafler, I know you're not going to be able to answer this, so we definitely need department staff. I looked quickly through all of this, and a lot of this has to do with specific training services or assistance to different counties or coming around particular programs, and now that was put in statute. And I'm curious to know, usually, does that mean that those services stop or that they were a limited time? Or are we not giving assistance to counties and other entities anymore, particularly, especially as it relates to the culturally competency, couple ones that were in here? I'm just, in general, I don't know if you can help me with that.
Excuse me, Representative Loeffler or to the testifiers. Thanks.
Mr. Chair, I'll let DHS clarify it further, but I was assured that these are all programs that either have expired, they were pilot programs that have ended, or that we have enacted new policy on these areas, and so this was actually kind of duplicative stuff within the statutes. But I will let the Department of Human Services confirm that to you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, for the two in chemical dependency, one was Hennepin County detox and the other was culturally specific detox. Both of those were only in effect when the state was funding detox. In 1976, the Community Social Service Act went into effect and took over that responsibility.
In what year?
1976, I think.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I guess I have one other question, and I don't know if someone else wants to address the other repealers. Were the repealers changed along with the edits that we're taking out of the rest of the bill?
Mr. Chair, no.
Okay. Well, let's make sure. I don't know if there's any correlation between what we deleted and the repealers, but we should just make sure that that all matches up. I don't know if my question makes sense.
Yes. I think that what you're saying is, did we, in deleting certain sections, eliminate new language that replaced this? And I don't believe that to be the case, but I'll let DHS confirm that.
Okay. That is exactly what I was asking. Thank you for saying it better to either of the DHS witnesses.
Mr. Chair, Amy Delwell from the Department of Human Services. Yes, I believe that the sections that we're deleting from the technical bill are conforming also with the repealers as well. They're deleting those sections.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. on page 35 of the 1998 House file, talks about, you're adding some language in here for the commissioner, shall meet the 15% requirement by either conducting an audit focused or an individual nursing facility. My concern is that the audits, and it was brought up in an earlier testimony back in, I think it was maybe January, February, I can't remember when.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lafa.
Representative Anderson, did you refer to House File 1998? We're not yet on that bill. We're on 1991.
Okay. Sorry about that.
When we get there. I know the feeling, believe me. Okay. Any further questions on this? Okay. Any further discussion to the bill members? Thank you very much, Representative Loeffler, for all your work on this and to the department as well. I know these are tough bills to work through. Further discussion? And to staff who worked on it as well. I'm not sure who that is, but thank you, too. All right. Seeing no further discussion. Representative Loeffler renews her motion that House File 1991, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
All in motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. All right. Why don't we go to 1998 then, Representative Loeffler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House Bill 1998 be considered or be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
Okay. 1998 is before us, and is there also a delete all on this one? Okay. Or an amendment, excuse me. Yes.
And I haven't actually got, it wasn't in my packets. I think that's another one to be distributed.
Hand that out. Oh, it was handed out. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move the A1 amendment.
Okay, Representative Loeffler moves the A1 amendment to House Bill 1998 to get the bill in the order the author wants it. Yeah.
I've just been told that there is also a drafting addition here on line 1.7 of the A1 amendment. After 33, add and 32, the number 32. So it's delete section 33 and 32.
Can we say 32 and 33?
We could do that.
Okay. All right. Does everybody understand that, that amendment? Okay. All in favor of that amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. You can. Representative Anderson, to your question. Page 35, you said?
Yes, page 35. I was just going to ask the question, Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, about why, and I'm glad you deleted it, but I guess there must have been a reason for having the language in there to make or shall meet the 15% requirement by the commissioner to do audits of nursing facilities, of multiple nursing facilities or other facilities out there. And I was just wondering the rationale for, I know it's been gone, but I just was asking, because I don't know if DHS can do that now. I mean, they did an audit on my daughter's nursing facility, not nursing facility, but group home, and it took them 2 years to do it. And my understanding from health commissioner that it was supposed to be 6 months, so I'm just wondering what was the rationale to put it in there to begin with. So,
Mr. Chair, Amy Delwell, Department of Human Services. You're correct. This section is being deleted at this point. However, to your question, what we're trying to do here is just allow for, you know, about 10 years ago, we had 30 auditors in the nursing facility area, and we're down to about 6 right now. And what this section is allowing us to do is to do some electronic auditing where we don't have to go and visit, 15% of the actual facilities on site, that we would be able to do some of that auditing by electronic methodology. Also, not require us just to audit 15% of the facilities, but also select certain criteria like the report card criteria to do that across the state to meet that 15% audit threshold.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The language still, even though you've deleted the new language, there is still old language there. I'm just wondering if the commissioner or the DHS can accomplish the 15% that's in law.
I believe that we have been meeting our 15% requirement to date for nursing facilities, yeah.
Representative Anderson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. You may have been needing it, but it's been a lot of extensions. At least I've gotten a lot of letters asking for extensions on the report coming back to me and others in our facility, regarding our facility. So my concern is that if the commissioner can do that, it's not on a timely basis.
Okay. Are you able to kind of walk through the bill briefly as amended? That would be great.
Mr. Chair, Amy Dowell, Department of Human Services. This bill is, we have an annual policy bill that we bring forward each year from the Continuing Care Administration. We cover long-term care services for seniors and people with disabilities. A number of the sections have been deleted from the bill moving forward, so today I'll review just the sections that remain. From Section 4 to Section 8, we're making some changes to the Long-Term Care Ombudsman program. We're clarifying that ombudsman staff have access to residential and residential settings such as assisted living facilities, adult foster care homes, residential hospice. And so it's just making clear in statute something that we're already doing. And then also it deletes some outdated terminology as well as updating or deleting some terminology. It's more of a technical kind of thing. From section 23 to 27, those sections cover the long-term care consultation area. And here we're clarifying that home and community-based waiver applicants, as well as alternative care folks, would be able to receive their screenings within 10 days. Also clarifying that the assessment that is conducted, that is valid for 60 days. And then making some additional clarifications. I believe there's a section there that has to do with withholding a portion of nursing facility MA payments should there be a past due payment due to a county for long-term care consultation. And I believe that was passed through this committee in an earlier bill. And then the alternative care sections, that's section 28 and 29, There's some conforming language to federal guidelines, and then also we're updating to clarify that the alternative care payment or alternative care program pays for long-term care services but does not cover co-pays, deductibles, and so forth. And then the last section is the elderly waiver section, and that is section 30. Here we're making conforming changes from our federal waiver program. Last year there was an assisted living bill that passed, and so we needed to make changes in our policy for that.
Any questions to the bill members as amended? I'm going to offer an amendment here, which is just going to add a section at the end of the bill. Here's copies. So it'd be adding a new section 35, although with the deletion it'll probably be a different number. And basically it's asking the Commissioner of Human Services to present us with a plan next year for providing catastrophic loss coverages to small businesses. So it's not asking for any change in policy, but it's just asking the Commissioner to, it's basically a study or to present us a plan to see if that's a possibility for helping out some small businesses in the state with their health care costs. Any discussion to that amendment, members? Okay, seeing none, all in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
Yes.
Thank you. Any further discussion to the bill, members? Seeing none. Representative Loeffler renews her motion that House Bill 1998 as amended be re-referred to Finance. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
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 All opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Is Representative Lane here yet? No. All right. I'll do mine.
Okay, welcome to the committee. Representative Tucson, House File. Would you like to move House File 1656?
I think it's 2178. We're
going to
move right now. We're at the top of the agenda.
All right.
We skipped over it.
All right, House File 2178.
And I think it's going to Finance. And I'm actually just going to have some witnesses come down and explain the bill. This is a bill trying to get some of our community care for older Minnesotans. And it's trying to give life to some, I think, unique ideas and some support to see what kind of supports we can develop into the future at the community level to support older Minnesotans. And I'd like Ms. Simonson to explain the bill, explain some of the ideas that they have.
Welcome to the committee.
And I think, Madam Chair, before we do that, I think we probably need to strike sections 2 and 4, which are great programs but deal with transportation. And in light of the date and the hour, I think we probably need to drop those at this point. So I'd move that sections 2 and 4 be deleted.
Sections 2 and 4 of the bill be deleted. All in favor of that amendment, do so by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay? The amendment's adopted. Ms. Simonson?
Thank you. My name is Dawn Simonson. I'm the Executive Director of the Metropolitan Area Agency on Aging, and I'm here today representing the Minnesota Leadership Council on Aging. I do have some information for you about the Leadership Council on Aging, a group of our, a roster of our members, and information about the proposal today. But I'll get right to the point. The Leadership Council on Aging was organized in 2004. We're a network of 13 primarily statewide Minnesota nonprofit organizations. And together we serve or represent well over 500,000 older adults. The council came together to speak boldly about the issues facing seniors in Minnesota and about what Minnesota faces in light of a dramatically growing older population. And we seek to raise awareness across the community about the demographic shifts and its implications for the social, physical, and fiscal fabric of our community. We're very concerned that the state is not prepared for the age wave in front of us. And if you take away only one message from our presentation today, it is this: make the demographic shift a priority for thoughtful, comprehensive policy development. Our proposal is known as the Community Care Act for Older Minnesotans, and it's based on three factors of enormous importance. One, long-term care is care at home. Family members provide more than 90% of care for elders. Two, older people prefer to live at home. And three, care at home costs taxpayers less. Community Care Act proposes three strategies: support family caregivers, expand home and community-based services, and ensure access to existing services. Our first strategy recognizes the important role of family caregivers as the backbone of our health and long-term care system. Helping family members provide care while maintaining their own health and well-being is essential to the economy of the state. For every 1% decline in family care, that costs the state $30 million annually. Our proposal establishes a tax credit for family caregivers of all ages of up to $2,400 annually. The bill has many of the same provisions of House File 313 presented earlier in the session by Representative Fritz. The most significant difference is the access and assessment mechanism. We propose a user-friendly entry point for application to the credit through the statewide toll-free senior and disability linkage lines. Caregiver counselors or other qualified personnel of local community-based organizations will perform the assessment to determine eligibility for the credit and to assist caregivers to connect with services such as respite and training. Our second strategy focuses on essential services. There are existing gaps that must be addressed to ensure that older people can live safely in the community as they age. The most recent county gaps analyses indicate that home modification, escorted transportation, and respite services are inadequate. These service deficits are long-standing. The Community Care Act requests funding to help fill these gaps by establishing new programs through the Minnesota Board on Aging. Services would be offered with sliding fee scale provisions. Home modification, volunteer transportation, and respite services are cost-effective compared to institutional care. Home modifications can reduce the use of in-home personal care services. Transportation with volunteer escort helps a frail elder get nutritious groceries and keep doctor's appointments, again critical to maintaining health status and preventing nursing home placements. Flexible, affordable caregiver support services modeled on evidence-based interventions help family members provide care longer, again delaying nursing home placements. In addition to service expansion, the Community Care Act requests restoration of funds reduced by 15% in 2003 for the aging grants that support volunteer-based services, including home-delivered meals, grocery shopping assistance, and companion services. I'm going to turn to my colleague Mark Poizier of DARTS to complete our testimony regarding access to services, and just need to mention to him the two strikes from the language.
Okay.
The mobility.
Oh. Okay, we cut it short then.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record. And
thank you, committee members. My name is Mark Poizier. I am the president of DARTS. DARTS provides a number of community-based services Don mentioned, including transportation, homemaker, and care coordination services for elders, and we are a nationally recognized provider of caregiver education and support services. The Community Care Act requests funding for studies of systems and access issues. The first is to evaluate the state's adult protection and elder abuse prevention services. These services were developed for an institutional model of care and do not have capacity to serve the growing number of community dwelling seniors. The second is to evaluate access to care and provisions for service development under the long-term care waiver program in light of the 2006 shift in administration from counties to health plans. The third is to address the lack of hospice services in some geographic areas of the state and for some populations.
Representative, yes.
Would you like to hear the information about the mobility issue?
Yes.
Regardless of the strike pay.
Okay.
If we would.
Well, originally we were looking at to establish a statewide priority for to enhance mobility of seniors. Currently, 14% of Minnesota drivers are age 65 and older. These drivers will be driving for a longer period of time, and there will be substantially more mature drivers in the future, especially women. We were looking to propose, especially that the Human Services Department of Human Services, coupled with the Mobility Center pilot, to learn best practices and demonstrate strategies for safe mobility. These would have included education, assessment of driver training, promotion of safer roads and walkways, assistance to families and older drivers in the transition to non-driving and the use of community transportation options. This concludes our testimony. Thank you for your consideration of strategies that will take steps to build a community care system that supports quality of life of older adults and that begins to lay a foundation for future policy development. We welcome your questions.
Thank you. Representative Thiessen.
And Madam Chair, looking at Section 4 again, it really is a Department of Human Services analysis, and I think that we can probably put that one, if we could restore that language as we move to finance, I think that would be appropriate. So I would move that we reinstate Section 4.
All members, all in favor of reinstating Section 4, do so by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
Thank you.
Adopted.
Madam Chair, I would just really like to thank the Leadership Council on Aging. I think this is a really incredibly thoughtful, well thought through, and practical program for getting at what really is a huge issue facing the state of Minnesota, and that we really haven't spent as much time. And I hope once we get past the finance deadline, we can have a few more meetings on this issue in anticipation of next year, because it really is probably the issue we need to take a look at in this committee.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Thiessen. You have in here independent evaluations several times in established advisory groups for every subdivision and division. There's an evaluation group but it's independent evaluations. And I'm just wondering what the cost of that's going to be to the department to have to bring all this these independent evaluators in. And then I was going to ask you also on page 9 about the additional appropriations. When you deleted the number 2 section and number 4 section, did the appropriations under Section 14, do they go away from deleting those sections? So,
Representative Anderson, I think the test bearers can address the issue of the independent evaluation. I think that the dollars, though, that you see listed in the bill would reflect the costs that they think are going to be incurred by the department for those things, and we'll obviously take those up in the Finance Committee. But specific appropriations are listed out here. With the deletion of 2 section, that second appropriation there, number 2, disappears. A2 on Section 14. But maybe the witnesses can testify to the policy question about the independent evaluators.
I think to the testifier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The intent here is that the department would issue an RFP so that a consultant or evaluator with the best qualifications would conduct the study.
Madam Chair, Anderson.
Does the department have any idea of who they might be, who's going to be doing the study or the evaluations or the advisor? Oops.
Representative Anderson, I think that would be the reason we do an RFP. You get proposals from a variety of different groups. I don't think this group, which is not the department, but this group has any particular people in mind to do those evaluations.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson.
That's the department?
That's the department, actually. Yeah.
Good. Welcome to the committee, yes. And state your name, please.
I'm Pam Parker, manager of the special needs programs at the Department of Human Services. We, as they have said, they're correct in that we would look for an independent evaluator through an RFP process. I would like to make 2 points. One is this bill has not yet been fiscal noted, and I do not believe the amount that's in there would be adequate for that kind of evaluation. One of the reasons that I would be concerned about it also is because in Section 8, where it's discussed about the evaluation of the managed care program, we already have just issued an RFP and just chosen a contractor for some of the exact same things, to evaluate the exact same things that are in this bill. And so I think it might be a little bit duplicative since that evaluation is currently just beginning to have some of the same issues evaluated again immediately by someone else. But I can the other point that I would make about that is that the amount of money that we've got out there for that evaluation, which is narrowed to case management issues and the impact of the transition from people into the Medicare, integrated Medicare, Medicaid managed care program, just those two things alone, we can barely get this evaluation done for $225,000. So with all the other things that are in there, I think probably there will be a little bit of an extra fiscal impact.
Thank you, Ms. Parker.
Thank you, Ms.
Parker. A couple of questions. Did you have a question, Representative Anderson?
No. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifiers. I think these are some really interesting, intriguing ideas in here, but I wanted to just ask a little more about the home modification part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly see the point, and I certainly see the value of doing this, but there was a statement made about the savings from this, and I just wondered if you had, this is a lot of money. It's a lot of money to put into an individual's home. And so I think that we would need to, and I know this isn't the Finance Committee, but I think just as a general policy matter, is there a return on this that can really be demonstrated? And then I think there's another issue, too, which is that after the public invests public dollars in somebody's home, what happens then? The value of the home presumably increases. Is there a mechanism for the public to retrieve that value when the person sells the home or passes on? Could you address those issues?
Ms. Simon.
Madam Chair, the issue with home modification is that there are some analyses where you can do a comparison of the home modification, the one-time investment, compared to the cost of providing care at home over time, and it does not take very long for that one-time investment to be recouped in terms of ongoing cost of care. The way that the language is structured here would require that a sliding fee schedule be established for these home modifications so that people with the ability to pay a portion of the home modification would be required to do so.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What about the second part of my question about recouping the value later on?
Madam Chair, I think he was trying to address that by saying that we actually are getting a return on our investment by keeping people out of the nursing homes. I mean, we can talk about whether, I don't know if the administrative cost of recouping that money out of the sale of the home would be worthwhile. I think you can address that as well. But.
Right. That was my point. There are potential savings here with one-time investment over cost of care over the long run. Again, the individual would be required to pay for a portion of the cost based on their ability to pay, and so it would not be totally public dollars. This would be matched with the consumer's ability to pay for that home modification. We don't propose establishing a lien program. This grant program would be targeted to people who are of low and moderate income above the Medicaid eligibility level. So we are really targeting people who are of limited means, but very important to keep them in their homes and out of the public Medicaid safety net, because that is where the state incurs the largest degree of cost.
Representative Levy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, I just, as long as, you know, I'm not necessarily arguing with you about it, I just think that that needs to be explicit, because whether we've actually recouped, whether it's been worthwhile in any individual case or not, you know, I mean, we could presumably modify someone's home. They die the next week. There's a $10,000 improvement that the public has made to their home, and then what happens to that? So, you know, I think that, you know, you may be right that overall, maybe the public would get value for this and would actually save money, but nevertheless, there is an asset there that's been improved at the end, and I just think that needs to be explicit.
And, Madam Chair, that is a very fair point.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to that last point, I have to say there's also an issue of equity, because if the senior just below that level is required to have a lien against their house because they're on MA and people of greater means don't, there's some issues of fairness in terms of the public investment having to be recouped in one area and not another, particularly require people to get onto MA to spend down to $3,000 for an individual, which is pretty, very, very minimal. My concern was, and I think these are important issues that we do need to address, and I agree with you, Mr. Chairman, that we really need to spend some real effort looking at this. I have concerns about the approach in this bill, because we seem to be creating duplicative service systems, and I don't think that's ever in our best interest. I presented a bill this morning that was from based on the Legislative Auditors Commission recommendations that we actually have to work on reducing the complexity and streamline our whole human service delivery system. And it was a policy adopted, I don't know how many years ago, that long-term care consultation by county should be made available to anyone of any income to assist them in evaluating their options and whether or not moving to a more accessible home would make more sense than a modification, whether or not an assisted living would be the appropriate next move as opposed to housing with services, to assist them in also identifying local resources, which might be the Boy Scout troop that will adopt grandmas to do mow and blow kind of thing. And so I'm very concerned about, on page 4, that we have a new assessment process being started up through the area agencies on aging when we have already established expertise and credibility. And I mean, as someone in the metro area, I don't think that the AAA is in any way near as visible to most people as their local county. And I think the counties do a better job of those informal supports of knowing, you know, our staff I know is dispersed by neighborhood even within our suburbs and city. And so they know who the volunteer groups are in that neighborhood, who the local nonprofits are that can help them much more than a metro-based organization. And so I just say, as we move forward, we ought to really look at, as we add these needed enhancements for people who are really struggling with a lot of challenges, how do we take advantage of the current system and enhance it without duplicating it?
Ms. Simonson.
Madam Chair and Representative Loeffler, it's an excellent point that county long-term care consultation reaches many people and has a very strong role in helping people understand their options and access services. But the senior linkage line of the area agencies on aging has a very similar role in the community. It is an existing infrastructure. The assessment for applications for the caregiver credit would happen primarily through the federally funded Family Caregiver Support Program organizations, which are local, community, and neighborhood-based organizations like DART, like Volunteers of America, like Project Rose in the Mankato area. So, indeed, while we do have we're not creating something new here, we are building on an existing infrastructure rather than a new program.
Madam Chair,
Representative Loeffler.
To that point, I actually am really opposed to that particular model, because I think that people, when they're making tough decisions in a transition point in life, really want objective information that's not connected to any service provider. And the organizations that you identified are wonderful, and they provide wonderful supportive services to individuals. But I think the people turn to the county. What I like about it being objective, and even if it was an independent case manager who in the private sector, a nonprofit or whatever, that wasn't connected to any service provider, but because we all know everyone is struggling with tight budgets, I think it's just important to have that assessment be done by an independent third party that doesn't, you know, gain grants, reimbursement, anything based on the provision of any of those recommended services.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. And Representative Loffler, it's an interesting discussion to have. Although in many of the discussions we've had about Representative Fritz's bill and his tax credit, one of the big complaints you've had is that the counties are overwhelmed with doing this stuff. And so I think it's worth exploring options outside of counties as well. I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with that.
Representative Ann.
Mr. Chair, perhaps you didn't pick up. I did say independent agencies that just aren't part of the billing system. So I'm open to that as well. I think the whole system is underfunded.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this question is probably to the department. So if I could. Ms. Parker.
Ms. Parker.
I know that in this bill, and we're a policy committee, but there's numbers in here for finances and things like that, and there's not a final number here. My only request is that that when this bill goes to finance, that we have a note there from the department as to what the actual cost of this is going to be. So I'm just hopefully asking for it, because lots of times we've seen bills come to the finance without a fiscal note, so I appreciate that.
Ms. Parker.
Madam Chair, Representative, I can't see your name, but we'll certainly try to do that. We often, I think, have to receive a request for the fiscal note, and sometimes the timing on that doesn't work very well. So I'm not in charge of the overall bill. I can just speak to the one section that I spoke to, but I certainly can give that message.
Thank you.
And Representative Anderson, we certainly will have fiscal notes and everything that goes into the omnibus finance bill.
At the next committee?
Representative Thiessen.
Not us. No.
Okay.
Members, any other questions? No more testifiers?
Oh, I do have one
you
more,
have
Madam,
one more?
Madam Chair. And that's we need to take lines 912 and 913 out. So I move that amendment. And it just corresponds to the section we deleted.
Okay, all members have that, all in favor of that oral amendment, do so by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. And that oral amendment is adopted. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And when the Fritz bill came through on the tax credits for caregivers, we had a short discussion about who would qualify as a service recipient. And I noticed that the language in this bill is the same as the language I flagged there, which is on page 3, line 31. Service recipient means an individual who is the spouse, parent, step-parent, sibling, step-sibling, etc., of the caregiver. And we had a discussion about the fact that sometimes we have nieces or nephews taking care of their aunts and uncles and all kinds of other configurations, or good friends taking care of their friends, and that why we would limit it to these particular individuals. And it did go to the tax committee. I did make a motion to the tax committee to take it out of that bill, and was told by staff there that it didn't need to be there for any tax reasons. So I guess I would make the same motion here to just to take out the text on 3.31 and 3.32, so that the service recipient would not have to have any particular relationship to the caregiver, and it wouldn't be limited in that regard.
Representative Thiessen.
Madam Chair, that's fine. It's really expensive. But that's fine.
Madam Chair.
Representative Eagler.
Yeah, I would think it would just incredibly increase the price of this fiscal note. So I think even the fiscal idea was expensive to start with.
And Madam Chair, this piece will be dealt with in the tax committee in any event. So. I'm open to that.
Okay, we're going to adopt that amendment by oral amendment. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay?
No, no.
Then adopted. All right, members, to the bill. Any, unless there's any further questions for Representative Houston?
Nothing further.
All right, we will refer House File 2178 to Finance as amended. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
And opposed, nay?
Thank you, members.
Bill is moved as adopted. And we're on to House File 1298 or 696. Representative Lane.
Madam Chair, I'll move the bill.
So Abler moves House File 1296. Welcome to the committee, Representative Lane. Please state your name and proceed.
This is Representative Carolyn Lane, bringing House File 1296. And I have two amendments, the first of which needs a small technical change, an error.
Which amendment is that?
So H1296A1, the A1 amendment.
Madam Chair, I'll move the amendment to incorporate the oral amendment she's been offered.
Thank you, Representative Abler.
The second, 1.3, where it says line page 5, line 20, it should be line 10. That's just an error.
Line 10.
Now incorporate.
Now Representative Abler incorporates that onto the amendment. Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay? Incorporated.
And then the A2 amendment needs to be incorporated.
The A2 amendment, members?
I'll move that amendment.
All in favor of the A2 amendment?
Aye.
Just by saying aye? Nay. Anyone opposed? Say nay? It's adopted.
Okay, I'll take you through the bill and then have some testifiers. First of all, I need to tell you, for anybody who doesn't know what a doula is, we usually get two reactions when I mention this bill. One is, wow, that's great. I would have paid double for our doula. And the other reaction is, what's a doula? So a doula is a woman that provides emotional and physical support during pregnancy, labor, birth, and postpartum. It's a one-on-one help, especially during labor. Now, if you look at the bill, we have deleted on the first page all of Section 1. That's the part that mandated it for insurance, and we are not mandating it. The second part is just simply says where a woman could have, you get information from your physician, and you will be accompanied by a family member or a chosen representative, and we're changing it to or both on the top of page 2. Or both, so that she could have her husband and her doula there both. Okay. So one or both. And then Section 3 just presents and adds a section in there at 2.28 where a woman has the right to have the presence of a doula while she's in labor. It just gives the right to it. And then the next page, Section 4, has the doulas all certified. There's 5 certifying agencies, and they should be certified. And Section 5 says that the Commissioner of Health will maintain a registry, which will mean that the doulas will submit an application, show their certification, have a criminal background check, and pay the fee. And that would be good for 3 years. And then Section 6 basically says that this registry is maintained and that it will be on the Department of Health's website. And Section 7 is the fees, and Section 8 that medical assistance would cover the cost of a doula for those not able to pay for one. And then we're adding an amendment, the A2 amendment added Section 9, which requires a study by MA related to comparing the number of epidurals, the number of C-sections in a woman with a doula and a woman without a doula during birth. So we just want some evidence back of how well this works. And actually, Representative Abler thought of that, and we'll move ahead with that. So at this point, I would like to introduce some of the testifiers so they can tell you how wonderful this idea is.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Susan Lane. I am a certified doula and a Lamaze childbirth educator, also certified for about 10 years now. You have in front of you a sheet that looks like this with cost comparisons. There's two columns, and then there's a central column. And I will explain that to you real quickly and walk you through it. I want to just introduce this by saying that right now Minnesota taxpayers are spending $68.9 million a year on cesarean sections for poor women. Not all women. That's just the ones that are paid for with tax dollars. The World Health Organization and the National Coalition for Improved Maternity Services think this is about twice as much as needed. The cesarean rate in Minnesota right now is 24.5%, that's as of the end of 2005, which is nearly twice the 12% recommended by the World Health Organization and indicated by obstetric best practices. The rate of cesareans in Minnesota has been going up at 1% annually since 1996. Rumor has it that the new Maple Grove Hospital is planning 4 surgical units on the maternity floor in anticipation of a 45% surgical delivery rate. Currently, several metro hospitals and many counties around the state have rates between 30 and 35% cesareans, 1 in 3 women. So it's not unrealistic that someone would be preparing for nearly half of all women to give their birth surgically. The cost of this is anywhere from $10,000 to $20,000 over the cost of a normal birth, per birth. And that does not include, by the way, and none of these figures, by the way, include the cost of the physicians. These are only hospital costs that you're looking at. Legislators have one option in front of them right now to reduce the cesarean rate, and you have some evidence of it in front of you now. There is more evidence. There have been 15 randomized controlled trials which have been peer-reviewed by the Cochrane database, which is the gold standard of peer review in medical science. And all of them showed reductions in all of these major factors. But the programs that you're looking at now are local. They all involve some MA funding already, which is paid to doulas, but not for not for labor and delivery. It's paid for prenatal and postnatal care. The Everyday Miracles Program, and we have with us two women, Deb Prudholm and Mary Williams, who are a part of that program, who direct that program and can speak to it, is on your left. And what this is giving you, this sheet, are the facts and data from the Everyday Miracles Program on the left, and then the Family Center Community Doula Program, which is in Ramsey County and serves women, low-income women in Ramsey County, is on the right. What is in the middle are the current rates overall, either Minnesota or nationally, depending on where they were available. The cesarean rate is Minnesota. The national rate is much higher. So what you can see is that without doulas, one would have expected there to be this is a sample of 722 births, just the ones that were referred to them, the ones that came to them. It is not a random selected sample, but it's the women that were served by these two programs during the period of 2006. There were 722 doula-served births. We would have expected that there would have been 80% epidurals in this group. There's hospitals in Minneapolis, Abbott Northwestern, for example, where the epidural rate is 97%. And those epidurals come with a $3,000 bill, not counting the physician. And I'd like to add that we are not advocating against any procedures. We are simply advocating for a choice of a service that helps to reduce the numbers of these procedures. Women who need these services, we are grateful that they are available to them in every way. The cesarean rate at the Minnesota rate would have been 69 more cesareans than these women had. So the number on the left of the cesarean rates, N equals 45 cesareans. Out of those, 372. N on the other side is 63 cesareans out of that 350. Had they been having cesareans at the typical rate, there would have been 69 more, and $10,000 per is a very conservative cost That's a cesarean with no complications. $18,000 more would be a cesarean where, for example, the baby had some breathing problems, which is more common with a cesarean birth than with a vaginal birth. So you could, that's kind of the way we went through this and looked at, well, in these two programs, how many women had epidurals? But how many would likely have had them if they weren't in this program, based on what our statistics are in the state? And then we went down with cesareans. And the big ticket item is low birth weight. And this is probably the most impressive. Because both of these programs had low birth rates, which are well below the average in Minnesota. And low birth weight generally almost always involves a nursery stay. And we have been told that the minimum cost of those stays are generally $50,000 per baby. One doctor said $75,000 is probably more realistic, but we took the conservative figures for this. There would have been 30 and a half and a half babies, but since the numbers are so high, I included the 0.5 more babies in that category. So it just goes right on down, and what ends up being the case is that we would have expected there have been $2.5 million more dollars spent on these 722 women had they not had doula care. That's the bottom line. The other aspects, the other numbers that I put on here, that boils down to about $3,520 saved on average per birth for those 722 births. The cost of a doula is somewhere between $700 and $800. There are other benefits that our research base for doula care that we have not been able to place a number on because we don't have local studies to show it. But women who work with doulas, it has been shown in national university studies, have less postpartum depression. And they also have increased bonding with their babies, meaning they say, the way they tested these things is they say more things about their baby that are positive. They hold their babies more. They touch their babies more. And so, and also we thought we should point out to you that there are a number of public employees who already use doula care, and that's also tax money saved because it reduces insurance rates. One of the persons with me today is Jamie Seely Kreisman. Jamie Seely Kreisman, and he is a small business owner who can tell you how doula care saves money on his insurance premiums if you'd like to ask that question. So we're hoping that we can have the opportunity. We don't do this primarily as doulas because we care about money. We do it because we care about women. This is a quality service. But I think there are rumors out there that this is not an evidence-based care, and it clearly is an evidence-based form of maternity care. It's effective in eliminating all kinds of problems that women have. It's quality care, and that's why we do it. But we hope you'll do it also because we need to save healthcare dollars. And we are very, very certain that that will be the case here, and we would welcome the study, but we'd like you to know that these figures also are already a part of medical assistance and can be validated in that way. So I think at that point I'll just see what your questions are.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
And I want to say special thanks to Representative Lean for offering our bill, and to Representatives Cheeson, Abler, and Otremba, and also Representative Clark, who is here. We really appreciate this opportunity. Thank you.
Representative Hemmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ma'am, you said certified. Could you tell me how is a doula certified? What's the minimum education standard?
Ms. Lane.
That's a wonderful question. Because we're hoping to get doulas from many more communities. We have doulas from who represent both our Latina and African-American communities where some of these statistics are very, very bad, who would love to tell you how doula care helps, particularly in those communities. The training that we all have is the same. There is a three-day training, intensive training session. There is a reading list, a paper that we have to write, and then the most important part, probably, and the part that generally takes the longest, is that each doula has to attend three births, and you have to have approval from the physician, the nurse, and the parents. You have to have a 4 or 5 rating on a 5 scale from all 3 of those people that you did a good job in this role. And then you submit that along with your writings and proof of your training and so on to the national organization. And that is how you're certified, to one of those 6 organizations. That's the nutshell answer.
Madam Chair.
Jeff Emmer.
Thank you. I'm wondering, this 3-day training session, is it offered in one particular place? Is it like the Doula University or something? And could you please give me an idea of what types of coursework presentations? I mean, is there a standard outline that's followed? Could you give me some information on that?
Yes, there's a standard of care for doulas. It varies slightly among the 6 organizations, but not greatly. The doulas are trained by women who usually have done hundreds, if not thousands, of doula services themselves and become doula trainers, and that is a separate course. We have 4 certified doula trainers in the state of Minnesota right now that I'm aware of. We might have 5. One of them is the nurse manager at Woodlands Hospital, who trains all of her nurses in doula care. So it's a separate course to be trained to train doulas. It's a train-the-trainer course. And I haven't taken that course yet, so I can't tell you what all is involved in it, but it is supervised, and you have to have the trainings that you do after you've been trained yourself. And then when you go out to train other doulas, you are observed and accountable to a senior trainer.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I should have made the question a little bit more clear, because as I understand it, you keep talking about care, and frankly, from what I've read, these numbers, there are no empirical scientific studies that actually causally relate any of the things that you've placed on here to doula care, as you describe it.
That's incorrect, sir.
Madam, if it's incorrect, could you cite me to the specific scientific study?
Yes, Lane.
I actually have something I can hand to you all. I didn't have time to copy it. That summarizes. These are the 15 randomized controlled trials, and they were reviewed by the Cochrane database.
I'm sorry. What was that?
What was that?
They were reviewed by the Cochrane Library, which is an international organization out of Britain that reviews. It's peer review of medical literature. All of these were medical studies done by doctors in universities. Then they're peer-reviewed as to the quality of the study, and that's what the Cochrane Library does. They review the quality of the studies and determine whether or not they agree with the conclusions. And so I have this information for you here. I can just briefly quote for you. Every effort should be made to ensure that the women's birth environments are empowering, non-stressful, afford privacy, communicate respect, and are not characterized by routine interventions that add risk. Continuous support during labor should be the norm rather than the exception. All women should be allowed and encouraged to have support people with them continuously during labor. Going a little further down this, I'm happy to provide you with the whole 138-page study or the executive summary, whichever you'd like.
I'll actually take both. And Madam Chair,
yes.
What you're describing to me, ma'am, is that it sounds like family. Family support should be there. And, you know, I guess we're going to start paying people to give support is a little disturbing. I happen to have been in the process a few times myself, so I think I'd probably qualify as a certified doula. The other thing that you should know is when you cite to studies and say these are all doctors in universities, last time I checked, you don't even have to have a college degree to be a practicing medical doctor in the state of Minnesota. It doesn't necessarily carry weight that it's a study from Britain. I would love to see the peer review. I'd love to do the background so I could understand it better. But from where I'm standing right now, looking at this, you basically are asking the legislature to mandate that insurers pay someone.
Actually, that's incorrect.
Okay,
that's
what am I missing?
Deleted from the bill.
Oh, well, okay. It doesn't matter. We're putting into law that this is something, we're giving it credence, and we're saying that we should allow this, right?
You can make the argument. I'm just telling you, we're not mandating anything in this bill anymore. So,
Representative Chair. No, Mr. Chair,
Emmer.
I'll be done then. Thank you for correcting me.
Okay. Representative Abler.
Madam Chair, I probably have to leave and go back to my day job, but I wanted just to comment about this bill and maybe help President Emmer understand or others who are listening. Remember the target audience, but also remember, if you spend the time and read what these folks help you do, and the way the healthcare system works now is it's changed a great deal. You often do a Rolodex doc. You go in, who's ever there is on duty, and the nurses you may not even know. This gives a consistency of a person with you while you're having the birth. If you have a secure relationship and you have a husband who's good at this, and I wasn't that good. My wife had a really good girlfriend come, or two of them. And they provided the same kind of support, and we had a midwife actually for our first five. And so that was already provided to us, not even knowing that's what we were getting. But the world has changed. And in particular, for the audience we're talking about, the medical assistance population, the high risk, high mobile, families that face many challenges that we're fully aware of what they face. They face a lot of complications, a lot of unnecessary costs, a lot of unnecessary damage to the child that could be avoided by a little bit of this care provided. And in my experience, just on the pure raw dollars, I think it's going to save money, but it's also going to improve not just the quality, but also the caliber of the experience with a woman. And so then they can get the bonding going, and the child can have a better connection, and many, many good things happen at that. So I hope that when the debate gets done, we can pass it out, and I'm sorry I can't be here to vote.
Thank
for
you.
Thanks, Caroline, for bringing
thank
this
Thank you, forward. Representative Chair,
Madam Chair, I guess Representative Thiessen, I guess what I would ask is it illegal to allow these folks to do what they're doing right now?
Representative Emmer, I don't believe
no, it's
so.
Not. The Maternity Care Center, which is a national organization that also sets standards for maternity care, has published something called the Childbearing Women's Bill of Rights, and they have indicated what services have been tested in courts and which have not. Doulas have not been tested in a court system, but it is the general opinion that while it may already be covered by the patient's Bill of Rights, there are circumstances in which it's been vague, and so it needs to be clearly spelled out. I think everyone feels that this would fall under advocacy as it's explained now. But we've had some problems in rural areas, none in the metro area. All metro area hospitals either have doula programs of their own or permit and in fact welcome us and welcome the care that we give. But it isn't clear. So it's just a matter of clarification, really.
Madam Chair, that doesn't make any sense to me. Representative Thiessen, if we've gotten rid of the mandate, if that's not what we're here for, why are we hearing a bill that these services are already allowed?
Representative Thiessen.
I believe that they'd be covered by medical assistance now. So there's no mandate, but if you look at Section 8 of the bill, which wasn't deleted. I was just trying to make sure that I knew that you had walked in late. My earlier comment, I just wanted to make sure that you understood Section 1 had been taken out of the bill, which was the mandate on the private insurers. But there is, we are adding as policy in here that medical assistance would now cover doulas, which it, I believe, doesn't currently. And so that. And that's why I said you can continue with the argument. I just wanted to make clear you understood.
No, I actually, Madam Chair and Representative Thiessen, I was here for the whole thing, and I was so disturbed by the fact that we're hearing this bill when we've got things up that the committee won't hear, like paying taxpayer dollars for killing babies. We won't hear that, but we'll hear this. And this is already allowed in law. And it seems now like we're taking that out, but is it an end run that this will be the first step, and then we're going to have the prepaid insurance plans start covering that? And you know what? With all due respect to these folks, because they believe in what they're doing, this is exactly what the family does. You know, you support, you're there, you do these things, you take care of yourself. There are many different reasons for the, as you know, for the issues that have been represented to be cured by doulas. So it, the I appreciate their passion and their belief, but they're already able to do this. I do have an objection, and I've stated it, to having taxpayer dollars pay for it.
To the author, Representative Lane.
Madam Chair and Representative Ellis, this is not in law at this time that the woman has the right to have a doula with her in her labor in the hospital. It is an option of the hospital to either choose yes or no, and we want to say that she can. I remember when I first had my first two children, which were twins, we searched around for one of the handful of doctors in the metro area who allowed the husband to be present and to do a more natural childbirth. That was not the standard back then, even to have the father there. Now we've come a long way with that, but we still don't have the law that would say that a woman who either does or doesn't have a partner with her can have a support person, be it a doula. And in this case, she could have both her husband and her doula there. And my experience has been that the fathers say they're absolutely wonderful. They're a godsend to both of us. They help me do my part. They do things I couldn't possibly do.
Okay. Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One last thing. And Representative Lane, again, I know you folks believe in this, but I'll tell you what. We should amend this and then say that the law should require that you can have your lawyer in the room, too, because I tell you what, that will make sure that we don't have some of the problems that we have as well. So we just have a difference of opinion.
Representative Tao.
Madam Chair and members, I noticed that on Section 4, we're defining a certified doula. I don't know whether that would have to go through the subcommittee on licensure. Representative Thiessen, what do you think?
Representative Tao, no, because we're not sending up a licensing agency. This is just for a registry. So I don't think we're actually not licensing any profession in this bill. As I understand the bill, maybe Representative Lane can...
Representative Lane.
As I understand it, I would agree with you, Mr. Chief. Representative Thiessen.
Okay. Mr. Chair, to that point...
Representative Finster.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Thiessen, to that point, aren't we paying some sort of licensing fees in this bill, though?
Madam Chair, I think we're paying fees not to be licensed, but to help the registry, to apply to get into the registry.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, who do the fees get paid to?
Representative Lane, you might want to help me out here, but I would imagine to the commissioner to set up the registry.
The Commissioner of Health to set up the registry.
Presumably the doula would pay the fee, which would cover proof of certification and would cover the cost of a criminal background check, similar to what I do as a reserve teacher every 2 years.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there anybody from the Department of Health or the Department of Human Services here? Because with the new A2 amendment, we now have put the Commissioner of Human Services along with this. And I'm just wondering if they could comment on their ability to do this, and I'm hoping that there will be a fiscal note when we get to the Finance Committee.
And Representative Anderson, Madam Chair, there's going to be a fiscal note for everything that is in the Human Services Bill. Okay.
Well, I hope so. Could I get a comment from the Commissioner or from the agency?
There's someone from the agency here who could come down and comment. Have a seat, Ms. Miller. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Chairman. Diane Miller from the Department of Human Services. I haven't seen Amendment 2. Could you just tell me what the amendment is? It's a registry.
Madam Chair, Ms. Miller, it talks about conducting a study relating to medical assistance, comparing the use of epidurals and cesarean sections among women who use doula services compared to women who do not. This study must 1, 2, 3, 4, so forth and so on. And I'm just asking for a comment from the, because it says, the first part said Commissioner of Health, and now because we're doing a study, we're asking the Department of Human Services to get involved.
To the testifier.
It's asking for comments.
If you're asking for a time comment, Madam Chair, Representative, this would take some time for the department to accomplish. We wouldn't be able to have it accomplished by the registry suggested time start of July, I believe it is.
Well, Madam Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Ms. Miller, it says August 1st, 2008.
Okay. We possibly could have that done by 2008.
And Madam Chair, Ms. Miller, I hope that when we go to finance, you'll have some kind of dollar figure for what it's going to cost you to do that.
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't think a fiscal note has been requested yet, but we'll have one.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Miller. And we are a question, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have some questions. But first, I just want to respond a little bit to Representative Emmer's comments about, you know, are we paying people to give family support? And just to point out that we do that in a lot of areas. That's what child care is, after all. I mean, the family is not what it used to be, and there are a lot of things. We just had a bill talking about services for elderly people to help them stay in their homes. Well, why would we consider some of those things? It's because families aren't what they used to be for many people. So, you know, I think, granted, there are limits to this. I'm not saying that we should now pay everybody to do everything that the families could and should do, but I just want to say that there are a lot of areas in which we do have to do this because we live in a world now where grandparents don't live around the corner. You know, used to, my parents grew up in a home where their grandparents lived right there on the next floor, but that doesn't happen so much anymore, unfortunately. So we do have to be prepared sometimes to provide the kind of support that the people do need and don't have in certain circumstances. Also, Representative Emmer, I don't know if I'd want you for my doula, and I don't know if you're going to be in my birth room. I'd rather have you there as the lawyer. But turning to this, to the more serious questions, I wanted to just ask Representative Lane or the testifier, what troubles me a little bit about the bill is that there doesn't seem to be any limitations in here in terms of what would be paid for, because I understand under the definition that a doula could be present or could be helpful through the whole pregnancy. And when we're talking about MA reimbursement, that gives us a pretty wide range. So could you give us a little more information about how much time we're talking about and what kind of charges? I know we're not the finance committee here, but just give us an idea. I think somebody said it could be $700 for a whole pregnancy, but I just want to know what kind of hourly rates are we talking about?
We generally spend 30 hours with a client on average. I'm in the process of spending 5 days with a client right now, and we'll be going back there, but sometimes it's 3 hours at the actual birth. But we do, all of us, as part of our standard of practice, it's required of us to spend a minimum of 3 visits, 6 hours prenatally, and the same postpartum, during which time we do childbirth education and breastfeeding and family support. This is the part that MA is already paying for in the Everyday Miracles program, and Deborah Pruthelm is here, who can speak to that, or Mary Williams, how that MA money is used in that program on the left right now. But it's paid to doulas. However, for the most part, doulas do not work on an hourly rate because we think that would be not pleasant in labor to be on a clock. So we contract per birth, and it averages about 30 hours, and it runs between $700 and $800 for an experienced doula.
Mr. Chair, thank you. The other thing that I wanted to raise with Representative Lane is, as I understand this bill, all we're really doing here is we're setting up a registry. We're allowing the doula to be in the patient's room, or, you know, if the patient chooses, which I think is a good thing. We should have that in there. And we're setting up this registry, and then we've got the MA reimbursement piece. And then we've got the study. And I just wanted to ask you, you know, given the tight financial limits that we have this year, if we were to not enact the reimbursement piece this year, would the rest of the bill still make sense on its own?
It would. However, I am going to suggest strongly that given the tight financial times we are in, we would save money this way. Right up front. It's not pay now, experience it a year later. It's pay now, experience the result now.
Madam Chair?
Representative Lane. Or, excuse me.
Oh.
Ms. Lane.
I'm sorry. It's not Madam anymore. Excuse me.
No, that's okay.
I think we should point out that the two programs that are on the left and right of the sheet you're looking at are already largely publicly funded. There's also grant money in them. And what they do is they throw in the grant money to pay for the time the doula actually is at the birth. And the prenatal and postpartum time is paid for through various public sources, some through the health department, through grants from the health department, some directly from MA and the community doula program. And we do have someone with us who can speak more directly to how that works. But so this isn't a new thing. Also, these programs are administered by MHP, UCARE, and I have... you can find out that you can, through MHP in particular, you can get a doula reference. So there is already public involvement in this project. And certainly in the hospital programs at HCMC and other hospitals like that, Unity, there are money coming from medical assistance. It's just that it's not particularly specified or clear yet.
Representative Levin, I think you raised a valid point. Why don't we wait and see what the fiscal note says, and we'll address that issue at the time.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I'm not going to move to take it out. I just wanted to know for future reference, and I just want to add that I do support this concept. I think it's very important to have these kinds of services available for a certain population that for whom they may be very important.
Thank you.
Representative Finston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a doula myself, by definition of what's been laid out here, someone that provides emotional, physical support during pregnancy, labor, birth, and postpartum, having met some of the requirements, specifically being part of three births myself, I want to speak in opposition to this bill. And I have a couple questions. We were talking about the fiscal note and the fiscal implications. This sheet here actually shows that this should be a positive fiscal note, so that would free up money, Mr. Chair, for the Finance Committee to spend theoretically $2.5 million from the sheet that you're handing out if the facts do truly add up. So as a doula myself, I want to know what I can do to affect the possibility of not having to go through a C-section with my wife, or how do I affect the outcome of low birth weight?
One of the things you do is you have to understand diet prenatally and what that has to do with the way in which the birth occurs. You also have to understand what kind of prenatal physical care a woman should have and on an individualized basis. So you would work individually. Well, in your case, there's only one woman, but if there were other women with them. You would also understand how movement and other kinds of comfort measures help an infant move through the pelvic corridor. The one way that you do not do this is by lying on your back through labor, but you do have to know how to move safely, how to open a pelvis. These are all non-medical, they are not drugs, but a prescription and funding for doula would act. I'm sorry, I forgot to ask permission to ask.
Oh, no, please.
I'm getting used to this here. Doulas would act like a prescription, like if you were to approve payment for a drug today, it would be paid on the basis that it was used. Not every woman wants a doula, nor needs to have a doula, nor should have. But those who benefit most are women in the most difficult financial situations who really can use the support. Childbirth is primarily a hormonal event, and it is that that has probably the primary effect. It's hard to explain in a nutshell how it works. But that's the idea.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, something you said really... stood out here. So in your presentation, you talk about doulas being able to affect the low birth weight, and in definition, it says emotional and physical support during pregnancy, labor, birth, and postpartum. Can you tell me when a doula would get involved in the pregnancy?
When the mother hires us. So that can be, sometimes we are, we've had women come before they're pregnant saying they want to be advised throughout their pregnancy, and we've had other women come 2 weeks. We've actually had women come a day or two before birth. And in the hospital programs, they call the doula in. There's four hospital programs in the metro area. Woodlands, Unity, HCMC, and Fairview University has, of course, its famous Somali doula program, and all of those programs, the doula just comes in for the birth. But the outcomes are better, according to the peer reviews of the research, if the doula works prenatally and postpartum with the mother. She eats better, she moves better, she stays healthier, she feels more confident. Women who produce adrenaline during childbirth, adrenaline is a hormone that will stop birth, it will stop labor. So it's simply if women are afraid, which I think a lot of women in this room can tell you that's the way they approach childbirth, that is a negative factor for their birth and can slow their labor and complicate it.
Mr. Chair, just that point, and I know the Finance Committee will debate this thoroughly, I'm sure. You know, you talk about MA covering this process, and as you pointed out, I mean, it could be 2 days or it could be a year and a half. And so then there's some different question amounts about caps and dollar amounts and what type of funding the program would need, what type of population is out there as far as what potential pot of money would go to what population. During your testimony, you talked a little bit about this being a bigger issue in greater Minnesota as far as doulas into the room. I want to speak behalf of my district in my area, and we have some of the greatest doctors and nurses around, and I've been through it 3 times, and I will tell you everything you've talked about, we have got that and then some. So I don't by any means want to make this into, and I know you're not, but I just want to make for the record clear that we have people that are doing this right now, and I know specifically because just 2 months ago I just went through it again, and I am going through it still.
Congratulations.
So thank you. One other thing, and then I will be quiet. I think I've let my opposition to this be known. But you talked about advising doula's role in advising on pain medicine. I think you advise because you point to the epidural rate and other things, and then you also talked about advising the woman on the different pain medications. So I want to know, in the qualifications, is there any medical background that, you know, quite frankly, after being through this 3 times, I don't know if my wife would look to me to say, should I have an epidural or intrathecal, or should I muscle this one out? What's the medical background and the medical experience that the doulas have then to provide them with that knowledge to make that recommendation?
We don't advise them. We educate them, and one of the ways in which we are trained is to facilitate the role between the client and her caregiver. So what we're more apt to do is provide her with some research and some background and the sources of it if she wants it. And the more, you know, the doctors and the lawyers that I work with now, they want every detailed research and study, and they get it. But oftentimes we're just giving them the information in a capsulized form, and then we suggest that they talk to their caregiver about it. One of the issues is that a decision about medications can't be made. You really can't make a lot of informed consent during labor. It's very difficult when you're having contractions every 3 minutes to weigh the 27 side effects of epidural anesthesia against the relief that you'll get. And so those are things that should be known and considered. The decision won't be made till the time, but they should be known ahead of time. And I'd also like to comment that I'm no way saying that every family giving birth in every rural hospital needs a doula. In fact, we only have probably 150 certified doulas today in the state. Most are in the metro area, though we do have an organization in Winona, in Fargo Moorhead, in Duluth, and in St. Clair Valley, as well as Minneapolis and St. Paul. This is only being, even for low-income women, suggested as an option. And for low-income women, most of the women served by Everyday Miracles are referred by their social workers or by their medical caregivers. So in your case, there may have been no issues, and you may have been informed, and you have possibly in a smaller hospital, a nurse has a lot of time to spend with the client. I've been at first where the nurse was present for 15 minutes in maybe a four-hour period in a metro hospital. So we are in no way saying that every woman has to have a doula. We are simply saying that low-income women who will benefit and have better health care outcomes really ought to have the choice.
Just a last brief comment, Mr. Chair.
Because you have some other members who would like to ask questions.
Sure. Well, we have time. It's midnight. Is deadline. Mr. Chair, I just want to point out that, I mean, what you have just said directly puts you in the middle of the patient-doctor relationship. I mean, that's not disputable because what you just said directly puts you there. And I will tell you, for instance, One of the last checkups before our due date, the doctor went over the different pain control, pain medicine that we could go over, laid out things very well for us, said if you have any questions, please follow up. From what I've heard from you is you said, well, when they're in the delivery room, they don't have the time. They're going through contractions every 3 minutes. They can't make that decision. So you almost implied without saying that you helped them make that decision at that point because they can't make it for themselves.
No, no. That's exactly not what I said, if I may answer.
Yes, that's, please do.
What I said was that we provide them with the information in advance of labor so that they have already had that discussion in their prenatal meetings with their physician. And then they make the decision. We never, ever make decisions for a woman. That would be the absolutely last thing we would do. It would be disempowering. And so, but we help her to have the information, the resources she needs, and to have had the kind of relationship. We like to build a trust relationship between a woman and her caregiver. And particularly with women who don't get a lot of care, that is not always there when they go into the hospital. So it's really to the contrary of what you just said. Thank you for asking the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members. I am intrigued that, you know, we have such a huge nursing shortage in different parts of the state, and it seems to me that that has been a part of the care team. When you're working in these hospitals, like I note that HCMC, Fairview University, Unity, Woodlands have these, I assume that you don't come in as just sort of the person from outside, but there actually is protocols within those hospitals, and there's a kind of a team interaction. Could you tell us a little bit about that and how that works?
Ms. Lane.
It's exactly that way. We come in with a woman, and you know, the nurse will come in and ask who is present and what their roles are, and we introduce ourselves. And really, in the metro area now, there aren't any hospitals that don't know doulas. And it is the nurse, of course, that we work with the most because she's present the most through the birth. And so we are partnering with the nurses. We stay continually. We don't shift change of if there's 5 or 10 different nurses, they really appreciate someone who has the background about the mother. We encourage mothers to be open and to share information that's relevant with nurses in answer to questions, which isn't always clear. So we work as a part of that team in all cases. And as I said, in order to be certified in the first place, we have to have a definitely positive rating from 3 separate births from the nurse and the doctor that we work with.
And Mr. Chair and members, I can just say that I've gotten a lot of supportive email on this from constituents, but particularly I think for our diverse community that we have, birth is one of the most personal, traumatic, wonderful things that can happen in a person's life. And particularly, there's a lot of different cultural norms. And what I have heard, and we haven't had a witness to this point yet, but what I have heard is that amongst the Somali community, a number of our ethnic communities, this is actually much more true to their cultural tradition, where they are much more accepting of another woman who's been trained and regarded with the right sort of appropriate sort of approaches to them in their community to guide them through that process. And so I think that this is just another opportunity, particularly when we have so many people from different ethnic and cultural backgrounds in our MA program. I think it's really wonderful that we are offering those people a chance to have this very important part of their life be honored in a way that respects their traditions and expectations. It's not for everyone, but I think it's a wonderful addition, and from what I've heard, particularly within our Somali community, has been really well received, much more so than the traditional American model.
Mr. Chair. Yeah. If we could have a short testimony from an example of what Representative Lauder was just speaking about.
You got members that want to talk.
Good afternoon. My name is Rhonda Seuss White, and I am a certified doula, birth doula. I have been for 9 years. I'm also a certified lactation educator. And I'm proud to be part of this and part of helping healthy babies into the world. I'm also a resident of North Minneapolis, and there have been studies that show that North Minneapolis has some of the highest numbers of low birth rate babies and some of the lowest incidences of breastfeeding. And when a doula is included in the mom's birth plan, those numbers change. I've been a part of that. I've seen it happen. It makes a difference. So I urge you to really consider this proposal.
Thank you. Representative Hamilton. Gottwald, I'm sorry. Representative Gottwald, I was sorry about that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I might have all of you beat as far as experience with the doula. I've done it 5 times. Yes, I have 5 children. I've been. Yeah, there was a gasp over there. I appreciate that. My wife probably would appreciate it even more. You know, we get into these discussions, and they feel almost partisan sometimes. I suspect the vote in the end on this bill will end up falling along partisan lines. It is legitimate to ask, and as I've been thinking about this, it is legitimate to be concerned about government's legitimate role. And since this is a policy committee, that's something to think about. We see and hear a lot of good things in society, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of good things. Some cost money, some don't. Some are things that we do, some are things we choose not to do. But I often find myself reflecting, what is government's legitimate role? I often think in these instances that the choice ought to be left up to women. And I think in specific instances where a woman is alone and fearful, these services could certainly be of some support and help. But if they're going to save money and if they're efficacious, I like the idea of letting the health plans and the health care providers figure that out. We've already heard testimony that there are many, many organizations already providing this kind of support, particularly in the metro area. And I question sometimes whether the state has to dive in at this point and say, all women shall have this option, or we shall pay for it. And that's a legitimate difference of opinion. You know, some people are going to choose to support this because they think it will save money and the state ought to have a role in providing this option. But, you know, there are many choices women make at the time of birth. Some of them choose to have a regular vaginal birth, sitting on a table, legs in the stirrups. Some people choose to do it in a pool. Some people choose to have it with their husband present. Some choose to have it without. Some choose to have a doula. Some don't. And I'm always a little leery of how much we inject ourselves into those situations and start mandating or dictating or making as a matter of state policy that we are going to do certain things. Because there's really no end to it. You know, I'm sure I could get testifiers to come up here and say that a woman birthing in a warm pool of water has a number of very positive things. All the women who have had that happen have had very positive results. So we should really require that a pool be made available and somebody to help them in that situation be made available. I think you get what I'm coming at. I don't question that the doula is a good thing in many instances. And like I said, I think I know how this vote will go. But the difference of opinion we have about where government's role begins and ends is a good debate for us to have in a policy committee. And it certainly has a lot of applications in the healthcare environment. So hopefully we'll keep that conversation respectful and move forward.
Representative Lane.
Madam Chair, there's nothing in this bill that mandates anything for anybody. And in fact, as you suggested, it can be an excellent option for a woman. And all we're saying is that for those who cannot afford this option, knowing the benefits that it can give to the outcomes for the baby and for the society costs in general, this option should be there for them.
Representative Hamilton.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Gottwald is much more articulate than I am, and I think he covered some of my concerns. And I know my wife, personally, if she could have any mandate, it would be that I would have the children, not her.
There you go.
But,
bring that bill forward.
Yes, and, you know, it's just,
when it comes to this, like Representative Gottwald said, you know, if the woman is alone and was scared and had fears and stuff like that, we could see a place. You know, I just keep coming back to the question is, how did the human race ever survive all these years without the watchful eye of government? And, you know, so that Representative Gottwald summed it up a lot more articulate than I ever could, so we'll just leave it at that.
Thank you. Well, members, are there any other questions for these testifiers? If not, we will refer House File 1296, Representative Lang, to Finance, as amended. All in favor of that, do so by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
No.
And the bill is passed on to Finance. Thank you. Thank you.
Should I go next? Oh, no, Representative Ward. Representative Ward. Representative Tao will move House File 2090.
Go ahead.
That it be recommended to pass and re-referred to Finance. Is there a fiscal note related to this? No? Oh, we can go to the General Register. Mm-hmm.
It was. It really was. All done on that one.
Representative Ward.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for having us today here on House File 2090. This is a bill relating to campgrounds and resorts in Minnesota. In my district in particular, District 12A in the Brainerd, Baxter, Crosby, Arrington, Nisswa area, which we hope you all come and visit and see us throughout the rest of the year. But in the state of Minnesota, the mom-and-pop campgrounds and the resort owners over a period of years have had this as an issue, and I think that we have now come to an agreeable situation, a workable situation with all involved, so that we can move forward with the economic development, economic experiment that the campgrounds and resorts offer our whole state of Minnesota. And I know a number of you have been hearing from your constituents within your area, especially the campground owners, and so this bill addresses that concern, and we think that it is a good bill to move forward. I have with me two testifiers today that will talk further to the bill, and we won't take as much time.
And President Tao, will you also move the A1 amendment?
Yes,
I can
move the
A1 amendment. To get the bill in that form, the author would like it, the A1 amendment. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? To the testifiers, please.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Kevin Matzik, and I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Minnesota Resort and Campground Association. Thank you for the opportunity to address the committee, and I'll be brief. The association represents approximately 500 businesses throughout the state, over half of which have campsites, and the average number of campsites for property is around 60. This bill here is the most important piece of legislation for the campground industry in Minnesota, and we thank Representative Ward for bringing this bill forward and strongly urge the committee to pass the bill. Mm-hmm. With the author's amendment, the bill allows for a hose bib vacuum breaker backflow preventer at water supply connections in RV camping areas, as opposed to a dual check valve device, which is currently required under Minnesota rule. And we believe that the current requirement is unnecessary and a financial burden to the campground owner. Health officials cannot cite a single incident of water contamination at a campground due to backflowage problems. RVs built over the last 35 years are required to have backflow prevention built into them. The EPA does not have a specific rule requiring the backflow preventers at the RV campsites. They allow through the Safe Drinking Water Act. They allow to give the states the authority to do that. And many states do not have require any device. Those that do, such as Wisconsin, allow for the vacuum breaker type, which we're asking for in this bill. The cost of the more expensive dual check valve is around $45 to $65, or about a $3,000 or $4,000 cost to the average campground just to purchase. And there's also a labor cost to install and remove them. the ones that are currently required need to be removed in the fall, or else they'd be damaged with the winter freeze, and then reinstalled every spring. And the time required for installation reduces the number of weeks the campground is able to be open for business. And one final point, one of our members received a brochure from a national manufacturer, and it specifically stated this is the device that's needed in Minnesota, and that one was about $50. The rest were somewhere around $7, the vacuum breaker one. So that's really the basis of my testimony. I'd like to turn it over to Don Kotke here. He's from Don and Mavis Crow Wing Lake Campground, and he can give you a perspective from an operator.
Been in business for 36
Welcome
years.
Welcome to the committee, so please state your name for the record and then proceed.
Don Kotke, Crow Wing Lake Campground from Brainerd, Minnesota. Madam Chair and representatives, I've been in business for 36 years, and this has been a problem with the health department inspectors over the years. I do have two of these hose bib type installed. They do work. I've had one since 72 and one since 78. And they're still working, but we've been told that they don't work. I don't know where they get their information from. The one that is currently installed, required to be installed, I talked to Dave Tischer from El Motel and RV Park in Alexandria. Brand new park, he had to install them. When the weather gets cold, they leak. Not only he has to take them off in the fall and put them back on in the spring, he has to close his season a couple of weeks early in the fall. He can't open up quite as early in the spring because of the cold weather. The water's running on the ground. I have not had the experience of this, but I happened to talk to him yesterday, and this is what he relayed to us. The problem that I would have in my park is attaching this new device to old plumbing. You're moving a water riser. You have to have wrenches on it, and it would break the seal in the ground. Mm-hmm. I have brass saddles that are attached to PVC pipe. The PVC pipe is in the ground. Everything else is brass or galvanized pipe coming out of the ground. So it would really be a headache to install these. And it depends upon the type of soil. I'm all sand where I'm at. I know campgrounds east of me, they're clay. I wouldn't have to hate to dig up a water break in the ground.
I would too.
Any questions?
Any questions, members? President of Board?
No questions, Mr. Chair. Members, thank you. We ask for the support of this. It really would help. It's going to help all campgrounds and the campground resorts in the state of Minnesota, and we really do appreciate the support of the committee.
President Gottwell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, I couldn't let you get away without a question. Just a point of clarification, this bill is exempting recreational parks from putting these devices on, correct? There was a little confusion among us. Somebody said, are you against this bill? Well, the bill exempts the recreational RV parks from doing this because you don't need to. That's kind of the assertion.
Representative Ward.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gottwell, that is correct.
Thank you.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Ward, my campgrounds, thank you for bringing this forward. This is a good bill, and I ask that my colleagues support it.
Representative Murphy? Okay. Any further discussion? Okay. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Ward, I just can't really let this go by without just asking you. I have gotten quite a few emails in support of this, and you know, I appreciate that everybody is really interested in this and that it's important to the campground owners, but what's on the other side? What pushback have you gotten on this bill? I mean, who is opposed?
Okay. That's barely phrased. That's been a word.
I'm sorry, I missed the first part. Mr. Chair. I'm gonna refer to my testifier.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the Minnesota Plumbing Code right now requires that the more costly the double check valves be installed at the at the hose bib site, and so that's been in plumbing code, and so when some of the inspectors come forward to inspect the campgrounds, they're saying that the code is saying this needs to be this is the proper one to have on there. We are advocating and saying that this vacuum, the less expensive the vacuum one, is sufficient. So it's really that's kind of where the issue is coming from.
And Representative Ward, to the testifiers, the Department of Health, you worked with them on this amended language?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. That is correct. This is kind of a collaboration. Actually, the author's amendment that was put on was drafted by the Department of Health.
And they no longer oppose the bill? Is that correct?
That is correct. They no longer oppose the bill.
And
Representative Ward, yeah.
And it does go along with the plumbing code as well.
Not sure.
Oh, President Gowell. No? Okay.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the Department of Labor and Industry.
Okay.
With the plumbing code was involved as well in the dialogue.
Oh, okay, because they run the plumbing code.
Yes.
Understand.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. Any further discussion? Seeing none. I'm sorry. It's very late in this week.
Mr. Chair,
we
ask for a friendly amendment.
No, President Tao will renew his motion that House House 2090 be recommended to pass as amended to the General Register. And
Mr. Chair, I'm glad that we could bring some greed to this committee, and it is our pleasure to do that.
And we need it, believe me. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Thank you, Representative Morton. All right, Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Chairman Thiessen.
Resident of Fritz Lewis, House File 1576.
Yes.
That would be recommended pass and be referred to finance.
Thank you, Representative Thiessen. And I do have an oral amendment. I have an amendment. I'd like to move the DE1 amendment, 576 DE1.
To get the bill in the form the author would like it, all in favor of the DE1 amendment say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
And I also have an oral amendment to the DE amendment, DE1 amendment on lines 2.28 after results, semicolon, end, number 4, county safety net protections to ensure the continued maintenance of county case management and other services for persons with disabilities.
Representative Fritz, you can speak faster than I can write. Could you do this?
I will repeat that. On line 2.28, after results, insert a semicolon. The oral amendment reads as end, number 4, county safety net protections to ensure the continued maintenance of county case management and other services for persons with disabilities. And I'd like to incorporate that oral amendment into the DE1 amendment.
All right, if you could just give us one more run through of that.
Ryan 2.28, after the word results, semicolon, and number 4, county safety net protections to ensure the continued maintenance of county case management and other services for persons with disabilities. Okay, members, do you have it?
Does everybody have that amendment, members? And I think we also want to take the and off on line 2.26.
Yes, I do. Thank you,
Representative. All right, so you just incorporated that.
Correct. I'd like to incorporate
it. Oh, we already amended it, though, didn't we? Did we amend it? Okay, so we need to amend it again. So all in favor of that amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Representative Chairman Thiessen. And with that, I'm going to turn this over to my testifier, Mark McAfee. Mark?
Mr. Chair, members of the Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mark McAfee with representing AFSCME. And thanks for the opportunity to testify today. For persons with disabilities, there are plans under current law to expand contracting under special needs plans to enroll persons in managed care to any persons that aren't required beginning January 1, 2008. It's our feeling with federal cuts that have come down to counties and a number of issues up in the air that we ought to really take the opportunity to take a look and see what the impact is going to be on county social services. Initially, when this bill was introduced, we had stricken that expansion and then put a requirement under this bill that a quality of care impact statement showing the effect on counties be done. What we do, Mr. Chair, members, under this amendment is restore the language for the expansion that's not touched under this, requires DHS to report by February 1, 2009 to the legislature on the initial results of the special needs plans to provide basic health care services under medical assistance to persons who are dually eligible. And then finally, there's a stakeholder group which we would expand to include some representation from labor organizations representing county social service workers, and also as regional plans, any regional plans go forward to include representation there. And we really think as we go forward, and it's my understanding these stakeholder group will continue to meet, that we need representation of frontline social workers and to really be thinking about how we can minimize how we can retain the county safety net protections as we go forward and we're going to proceed with moving people into managed care. So with that, I would end and thank you, sir.
Representative Vowell.
Mr. Chair, I'll ask this in the form of a question eventually, but as I understand this bill, we are now instead of making an unbiased determination of Medicare special needs plans and how they should be dealt with, we're going to insert into that process employees involved in delivering care in the decision making about how to set up a delivery plan for health care. We're going to add the labor unions to the process here, and they're going to have, it would appear to me, and I'll put this in a form of a question, correct me if I'm wrong. We're inserting the labor unions whose jobs may be affected by this, I understand, but we're injecting them into a decision about how we ought to deliver Medicare and Medicaid services to these people. I guess I have a concern about that, and I'd ask you to correct me if I'm wrong.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, this stakeholder group is advisory. It's advisory. And, you know, I think we see no harm in adding our representation to the list. We're not making, Mr. Chair, Representative, we're not making the decision on what's included. This stakeholder group is advisory.
Representative Gottwald.
Mr. Chair, my point again is, though, that this is a stakeholder group that's supposed to advise on a proper delivery system of health care services. And if I'm reading this correctly, it says the stakeholder group shall include representatives of the counties and labor organizations representing, and then it lists county social service workers, members, consumer advocates, and providers. If I'm reading that wrong, tell me, but I realize changes might affect the unions, but I'm wondering, are we talking about unions representing each of those groups, or are we just talking about include representatives of the counties and labor organizations representing social service workers? Members are separate, or are we having a union representing them, consumer advocates, providers? You see how I'm reading that?
Yeah.
Well,
Mr. McAfee.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I mean, our intent is that we have the frontline workers represented in addition to, you know, county administration. We're not... that's really what we want, is to ensure that we have that type of representation.
Mr. Chair, my point is, if I'm in the private sector and I'm looking at changing a process, I don't call the workers in already doing it one way to say, develop the new process. I may have their input, but it's... Instead of having an unbiased position, you're going to have people, I think, advocating for the status quo, or perhaps advocating for something that affects their jobs rather than what affects healthcare outcomes best. I'm just a little concerned about adding that element to this. I'm not sure why we have to have the labor unions at the table when, in fact, we should be looking in an unbiased way at what delivers the best health care. It may, in fact, be good for union workers. It might not be, but it ought to be looked at that way rather than, you know what I'm saying?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative, with all due respect, I think anybody that's at the table, you know, it's called stakeholder group, may have a different perspective on it. I will assure you that the, you know, the social workers and others that we have that happen to be our members, they're very dedicated to providing services for persons with, you know, disabilities, or persons that may have behavioral conditions or other sorts of things. So we really want to just we want to ensure that as we go forward, that we're looking at the impacts on our, you know, our existing county safety net, and you know, this is not collective bargaining. That's a separate type of thing. But I think as far as having an interest, I would certainly submit that the you know, the health plans have a financial stake in this sort of thing. They've been involved and at the table. You know, and certainly the consumers or advocate groups, I might add, you know, we visited with them about this, and they have no problem with adding our, you know, participation to it. So,
thank you. Was there a Fritz?
Further questions, members? Okay, seeing no further questions, Representative Fritz renews her motion. That helps. Oh, we have other testimony. I'm sorry. Mr. Griffin and Ms. Parker.
Okay. I think we have a little problem with something here, so we'll try to fix it. Mr. Chairman, members, Pam Parker from Department of Human Services, Special Needs and Care for Assisting. I'd just like to point out two things. One is that the on the study in Section D, that program is just going to, that's referenced there, is just going to be starting in 2008. And so 2009, you know, I don't know if there'll be much to study yet. I think we're very willing to study it. But just wanted to point that out too, that it might not be right for the, much to say yet about it in 2009. The other thing was that the amendment that was just put on verbally, which I don't have a copy of right now, but I know that Mr. McCarthy tried to show it to me earlier, and I thought it was going to be okay, but I couldn't read his writing. And then when I saw it, unfortunately, there are some things in here that we have a real problem with. I think it's fine to add the county safety net protections in here, but the words "to ensure the continued maintenance of county case management" is of concern to us, because it seems to lock us into one model of case management. And under these programs, we already have other models of case management under the stakeholders, the programs that they're going to be advising. And I believe that the department has worked with the advocacy community to endorse some choices of case management programs. While, of course, the county case managers provide an incredibly important service to all of our programs, that's not sometimes the only choice, particularly in some of these integrated Medicare Medicaid programs. So we would prefer if that language was stricken, but certainly the concept of looking at the county safety net protection for services for people with disabilities, we can understand that would be appropriate. Thank you.
Mr. Griffin.
Mr. Chairman, and Representative Fitzwee, Bill Griffin, representing UCARE Minnesota. I haven't had the opportunity to talk with the author and didn't know this amendment was coming, but we would reiterate the concerns that Ms. Parker has expressed on behalf of the department. UCARE, as you know, is working with the counties to provide a number of these services. In fact, most of those services are provided through county workers. So there is a stakeholders group that is a public group. It's not dominated by one particular group or another. If the unions are interested in participating, they're welcome to come to that table. And we would also point out to members of the committee that these programs on behalf of the recipients are voluntary, so we're not mandating people into these programs. And I think Representative Atwell's concerns are expressed quite clearly in terms of where the public interest lies.
Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Chairman Chiefson.
Thank you, Chair Members.
Thank you. On the oral amendment, I spoke with Ms. Parker and Mr. McAfee, and we are willing to work on that language going forward before we get to finance. But we also, or could I have one moment just to confirm, Mr. McAfee, if you could come up?
Representative Loffler has a question.
Okay, Representative.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Fritz, if I took it down correctly, that the oral amendment just says that they can explore it, and it's an advisory committee, so it's not saying anything. They're just going to look at it. But I'm wondering if you or your witness could identify if this is, since it's a voluntary program, if the issue is with like small counties where you would have so many volunteer out that it wouldn't be sustainable to keep a county case manager for those who choose not to? I mean, is that the concern that's addressed here? Because that might be a situation that would be legitimate. I don't know how fast this is rolling out or where, but I'm thinking that that's a legitimate thing for an advisory or stakeholders group to consider. It is voluntary.
Representative Chiefson, if I may.
Representative Fritz.
Well, we have, I could change the amendment if I might. Change the oral amendment.
So I think you need to make another motion to amend.
I'd like to make another motion to amend the oral amendment.
Okay.
And that would say, in the same place, number four, county safety net protections for persons with disabilities.
Okay, so the language, the amendment is to strike the previous oral amendment, the language that was inserted, and insert in its place.
Number four.
Number four, county safety net protection
for persons with disabilities.
Okay, any discussion to that? I see some nodding heads, so. Okay. All in favor of that amendment, say aye.
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 Okay. All opposed, say no. Motion is adopted. Okay, further discussion to the bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fritz said exactly what I was going to propose to do.
Thank you.
Okay. There we go. Further, Representative Huntley.
Well, I've gone, so I thought I'd come here and say something, but so they can put on the record that I was here, but there's another state program very similar called MSHOW, which is Senior Health Options, which also has gone into managed care, and that program, I'm a little bit familiar with it in Duluth, and when it started, again, it's back to coordination of care, the Duluth Clinic in this program hired a bunch of nurses to work in each of their clinics to basically manage the patients in MSHOW, and they found that those nurses were, at least at the start, were spending a lot of time calling social workers to figure out how to deal with these people and try to coordinate the social work with their actual health care. And initially there was a certain amount of tension between the nurses and the social workers. But after a while of working with it, they all came to the realization that there was plenty of work for everybody to do, and they really weren't competing. And I think this program, MINDO, will work out the same way, and it certainly does not bother me to have the stakeholders group to sit down after a year and figure out what they did right and what they did wrong.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Fritz renews her motion that House File 1576 as amended be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Yes.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. There's one more bill to go.
Thank you, members.
Madam Chair, I would move that House File 1656 be recommended pass and referred to the General Register, and I do have some amendments too, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative.
I move on line 3.21 that the words offer for sale, sell, be stricken, and on line 3.24 that the lines offer for sale and sell be stricken, and that lines 4.11 and 4.12 be stricken.
Kristen Keithman, just to make sure everyone's on the same page, would you please just repeat that again?
Yeah, on line 3.21, the words offer for sale, comma, sell, comma, be stricken. And the same language stricken from line 3.24. And then lines 411 and 412 be eliminated.
Thank you. Members, do you have that? Any questions? If not, all in favor, vote aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Amendment is done.
Members, this is this legislation is actually coming forward from the jewelry industry. It basically is getting at what's a very serious issue about lead jewelry. We've had examples in this state and in other states about children in particular swallowing lead jewelry and actually dying. What much of this legislation is are standards that have been developed by the Federal Consumer Protection Agency in conjunction with industry standards about the levels of lead in manufacturing protocols for lead for jewelry that contains some lead. And I think it's an effort by the jewelry industry to say, you know, we have a concern here about the health concerns and we want to do what we can to take care of that. That's essentially what this bill is about. I guess I will stand for questions. The changes that we made, there were some concerns on behalf of the retailers, especially small retailers, that there's some manufacturers about the, having liability on the retailers instead of just the manufacturers, because they don't always know whether there's lead or not in their jewelry. And so that was the gist of the amendment. We, I just for full disclosure, we are going to continue to work on that language to make sure that we can strike the proper balance on that issue to pick up some of the smaller suppliers of this type of jewelry if we can find that language. So members, that's the bill.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Thiessen, you took out the violation section, subdivision 3. What's your method of enforcement for this as far as, I mean, I know that as businesses and stuff like this, we purchase a product for a company, and in return for it, there is gifts and stuff that the manufacturer, the person that is the wholesaler, provides to us, and it's from out of state. In fact, it might be from even overseas. I'm just wondering how you control, because we don't know what we're getting except that we order the product, we get the product in, and then all of a sudden, weeks later, these little trinkets or gems or whatever, they come forward as a thank you for purchasing from the wholesaler. So is there something that we or my company would have to do to say we can't accept this kind of thing? Or what is it that is got to be made notice to the purchaser, the retailer who's going to be buying this from wholesaler? Now, what happens if you get that? I mean, are we subject to some penalty of some sort?
Representative Thiessen.
And Madam Chair, I'm not sure who the we is in your question. I'm sorry.
I'm talking about my company. If
and I'm not sure what your company is. I'm sorry.
Well, I'm just saying if a company purchases products and the products happen to be as we get...
Are you a retailer?
That. Yes.
That the language that I amended out at this point would take you out of... the liability.
Okay, what is the penalty? Sorry, Madam Chair.
And as to the penalty question, Madam Chair, I think it would fall back to, I think if you have a prohibition in law, my recollection is that if there's a prohibition in law and there's no penalty specified, there's a misdemeanor penalty that's placed on it. The reason I took out 8.31 is that is a very serious penalty that provides for attorney's fees and civil actions by people and is much more than we need in this circumstance. And so that's why I think it's an inappropriate penalty for what would really be kind of a strict liability offense. That's a consumer fraud kind of penalty.
Representative Butwell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Thiessen, can you describe the current situation, what this is getting at, and then what are we going to notice different once this is enacted? I notice there's a long list of things, but in practical terms, what's happening now, what's going to happen if this becomes law?
Madam Chair, Representative Gottwald, what's happening now is we don't have regulation about the amount of lead that can be in children's jewelry. And what this would do, it would require that jewelry, well, all jewelry, really, body piercings, jewelry, but specifically children's jewelry, there's lower standards for children's jewelry. We'd actually have standards in place, so what's manufactured has to meet the specifications set forth in this bill, which are based and are identical to a national standard that's been adopted by the Consumer Protection Agency. It doesn't have force of law. That's why we have to do this. And the manufacturers are moving to comply with that, and we just want to have this in place so that in fact occurs and there is some backup to that.
Representative Gottwald?
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, how would imports be involved here? Would these apply to jewelry imported from other countries? Because I know there's a lot of that out there.
Representative Gottwald, it would apply to any jewelry that's manufactured and sold or distributed in Minnesota. So presumably the import would come in. and would have to meet this requirement. And if it comes into a distributor, which is typically how that would happen, that distributor would also be liable for certifying that this lead jewelry before they sell it to the retailer.
Representative Hunt.
Chair, that may have resolved the issue for me. We had a bill up related to this topic a few nights ago by a different author. Is that correct?
A much broader bill, I think.
Okay.
Members. Yes.
Okay. So you may just ask, in your section where that on 3.1 where you deleted the for sale language, the title of that section is sale prohibited. I just wondered if since you took out the for sale aspect, whether you had wanted to change that at all. That's just a technical point.
Madam Chair and Representative Budden, I think that the manufacturer is still, what we're getting is sales of those goods that were manufactured. So it's not just manufacturing in Minnesota, but manufacturers that, sell into the state as well. Yes.
Regarding the issue of the importation, you're saying that the whoever receives it here might be a distributor, but it also might be a retailer directly from ordering for something from overseas. And this issue came up in our previous discussion about whether retailers needed to use some sort of invoice form that they had in order to indicate whenever they ordered anything from any manufacturer, particularly if it was not in the state, that by accepting that order, that they were acknowledging the Minnesota law regarding the lead content. Is that addressed in here in some way?
Well, and a very good question, and that's what I was trying to get to. Let me tell you more specifically where this legislation is. Mm-hmm. The Senate has passed this legislation. It's sitting on their general register with the retailer still liable. Mm-hmm. And obviously we are taking out the retailer liability. The questions that you're raising are exactly the ones that we've been struggling with all session. And there's a commitment that I have made and the Senate author has made and we've made with the representatives of the retailers, and I don't know whether, Mr. representative of the manufacturers, that we're not going to move forward with this legislation until we get that particular detail worked out, because that's really the sticking point. Nothing will happen unless we can figure that piece out. Mm-hmm.
Seeing no further questions, Representative Thiessen renews his motion that House File 1656 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register as amended. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
Yes.
Bill is passed and as recommended and is going on to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Thiessen.
And that's it, members. Thank you very much for all your hard work. I should just say thank Erin for all her work so far. We'll probably be having some meetings before the end of session, but since we met deadline, thank you for the last 2 weeks particularly. It's been a lot of time. And to Jen and to Ursula and to Jan and to Lynn and everybody else
who's
here. So, anyway, thank you.
With that, we're adjourned.
Thank you.